Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard. Not the billiards. It was...
Billiards room.
Come on already. Come on. We call it the...
The place to be.
The place to be. Yes, the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
That's what she said.
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be Podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Like, I can't understand a word he says. He mumbles. He sounds like he's on, 15 Ambien when he's on the show.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
And then they trash him and say he's a fucking pill-popping, pothead or whatever when he left. I don't know if it's his misshapen body or his shorts that are pulled up over his belly button, his stupid sandals. I don't know what it is. I don't know the fuck the Department of Health is.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
I ain't afraid of no ghosts. I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
Place to Be a Nation. Welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, and joining me, as always, on this stormy, weird night, my PIC, Scott Criscola. Scott, how you doing?
I'm well, JR. Still with power, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 172. Of the Place to Be podcast. And I just want to say, and I'm not saying this to be derogatory, we love you guys.
Yes.
But if there's ever a night where you think we don't have dedication to you or this show,
yes,
tonight is it.
Right.
Because it's the taboo episode in terms of guests, and God only knows what the heck could happen either way. JR's already shown us a picture. He texted me of a tree split in half. My sister's boyfriend's garage exploded, in essence. It's crazy here with Danny's girlfriend from Greece here, Sandy, blowing through the Northeast. So, but we are here, and finally, we've arrived at one of our more anticipated shows in a while. Of course, JR, we are concluding.
Yes, this is pretty much puts the bow. Well, yeah, pretty much puts the bow on it. We're going to wrap up the year of 1997 in the World Wrestling Federation.
Yes,
by bringing in, of course, Kevin Kelly, who we'll get to in a moment. Scott, we've gone through all of this year. We've talked a lot of things, and I think it's cool to have that insider's view.
Yes, absolutely. And Kevin has been there. And he's one of our favorite guests, and we've had a lot of issues with scheduling and everything.
Yes,
and we were even up until game time. It was almost I felt like he was Mr. T, and we were Hogan and Vince at WrestleMania. We're like, oh my God, is he going to be here? Oh jeez. And he's
here,
coming up shortly.
Yeah, so we're really looking forward to it. Okay, so Nation, it is now time to bring in one of our favorite all-time guests here on the Place to Be podcast. We've tried this twice before in recent weeks, and we finally got him here. The third try was a charm, Scott. So let's bring in our buddy, the one and only Kevin Kelly. Kevin, welcome back.
Woohoo! Yes.
You're blown in like Sandy.
There will be no illness, nor sudden hurricanes or anything that will stop us from talking about the year 1997.
Yes, not at all. We're all weathering the storm right now, and out of amazement of all nights, we're actually able to squeeze this thing in. So,
can I give you guys my little theory about this?
Sure.
I think if you're living where the tides are rising and storm water is flooding your basement or overtaking your seawall or whatever, it's bad. Okay? Don't get me wrong. However, I think that they're making more of this than there needs to be. I don't trust anybody anymore in the media, and I think that this storm is a lot of nonsense. I think it's bad, and it's bad if it's bothering you, but I don't think it's as bad as it's cracked up to be.
Yeah, I think a big part of it, like you said, is just where you are. If you're on the coastline or anything like that, it seems to be a ton of flooding, but if you're inland,
yeah.
It's really just the wind knocking your power out. I mean, I think that's where the danger lies, right?
Right. I think it's, again, and why are they doing that? I have no idea. I don't have any rational thoughts. I mean, it's not like I'm being sensible, but again, it's just something that was creeping across and watching hour after hour after hour of television coverage. How bad is it going to be? Keep thinking, when's it going to get so bad? I don't know.
Well, maybe we'll do a whole weather podcast.
Yeah. Well, you know, it seems like what I've been watching all day today on various networks, it's just, you know, when it comes to any of these East Coast storms, pretty much the whole moniker of it is, if you live in New Jersey, you're usually screwed.
Yes.
Pretty much what it comes down to. Anywhere else, I mean, obviously, I live a little closer to the epicenter than JR does. Obviously, you've shown me pictures, JR, of one of your tree near your house getting split in half. My sister's boyfriend's garage got ripped in half, and he lives on the shore between West Haven and New Haven, Connecticut. So there are some pockets. But I agree, Kevin, that I think they – I mean, weathermen look like heroes when they can look like, you know, like the apocalypse is coming and then like, wow, we didn't do too bad.
Well, the thing is, they actually kind of called this one, though, because they predicted that the hurricane would hit that nor'easter and combine it to some kind of super vortex of wind. So, I mean, they actually nailed that. But, yeah, as far as the impact around, you know, I feel like we're jinxing all of us, so maybe we should stop because
right,
we're like a half hour from now, we're all just going to go complete black, probably.
Exactly. Let's set the time machine and go back to 1997.
Yes. Yeah.
Speaking of a hurricane, wow. There was a hurricane of activity, emotions, characters, people, announcers, everything. But before we actually get into the year of 1997, K-Squared, we're going to go back a little bit further. Bret Hart loses at WrestleMania 12 to Shawn Michaels at the Pond. Okay? He leaves. What was going on during that period? With Bret gone, in terms of was the rumor strong he wasn't going to come back? You know, he's a little rankled, a little pissed off. You know, he was doing the Lonesome Dove movie and stuff like that. How close was it during that time before he was coming back in October that he wasn't going to come back at all?
I think it was, depending on who you would have talked to at that time, it was either never going to happen or it was very likely. You had a full range of beliefs within, with Bret Hart in terms of what he was going to do post WWF after he lost at WrestleMania. He was still under contract to the company through August, I believe, or through July. And the idea was he was going to take some time and get this done, and he and Vince were going to talk, and they would get their they would get this worked out eventually. I was always, when I started in June, that was sort of the belief, is that eventually Bret was going to come back. And then it was, Bret's coming back, isn't he? So I think as it got closer to the actual day, we're in Fort Wayne, and he told Vince in the middle of the ring, yeah, I am coming back, and Vince saw that physical sigh of relief, which was a legitimate reaction. He knew the deal was done by then, but that was how Vince felt. As it got closer to that date, a lot of us were kind of like, he is coming back, isn't he? He's not leaving to go to WCW, is he? Really? Oh, yeah, we knew it all along.
So I want to ask two versions of this question, but one I'm going to ask now, and then we'll pick it up again when you hit the end of 97. Do you think it would have been really bad if you went to WCW in the fall of 96? Like, how? At what point do you think it's the death kill, the death blow to the WWF, and the winning blow for WCW, or do you think it, you know, would not have been as big a deal as it seemed at the time?
Oh, I think that the way it worked out was so much better for the WWF. If he would have left in 96, I think it would have just been, we never would have had what happened in Montreal. We never would have had Vince's character come to life. We never would have had the us versus them. Plus, Bret may not have gotten as much money as he did from WCW. I don't know what kind of offer was on the table originally, okay? But I know that Vince kind of let Bret, he re-signed him the 20-year contract, then had to tear it up, made him free to renegotiate. Bret went back to WCW then and got more, you know, was it going to be the same deal? Was it less money? Was it more money? I think it was more. And part of the reason why that worked so well for the WWF is that Bret went down there and was sort of a marked man. Everybody hated him. Nobody was really a big Bret Hart fan because they were Hulk's boys, right? And Bret came in, was making $3 million a year, more guaranteed than most. And there was a lot of bitter feelings from a, you know, pretty discontented bunch of undeserving underachievers, if you ask me.
Yeah.
But that's why I think that it worked out better for the WWF, that it happened the way that it did. If he would have quietly left and you know, in the summer of 96, right after, let's say, Brett, or right after Hulk turns at Bash at the Beach, then he signs on and he's, you know, maybe making $1.5 million, $2 million a year, whatever. Yeah, he's still making good money, but he comes in as more of a top guy.
Right.
And without that, without the hype and uncertainty and all the controversy that was in Montreal. So it worked out much better than the way it worked out for the WWF.
Okay, so he comes back and, you know, set to feud with Steve Austin. And I believe we talked about this last time you were on, how that whole feud came about. Around the same time as Survivor Series, Sid defeated Shawn Michaels for the world title. And it looked like Michaels was actually going to turn heel. He started to show more heelish tendencies throughout the winter. But then by the time they arrived in San Antonio for the Rumble, he was back to being a face and took the title back. You know, was that, did that go as designed? Was it an aborted heel turn? And if so, why?
That was a New York, I'm a petulant child and a pouty baby. And I want the people to cheer for me, and they're not. So I'm going to, you know, act like a jerk. That's all it was. They'd already booked San Antonio, Shawn's hometown, for the Rumble. So he couldn't turn, you know. And so we just had to kind of play it off like it never really happened. And it was, you know, New York being New York, bizarre world, Shawn being Shawn, passionate, you know, and all the things and all the machinations that they did. Fans in New York, very, you know, they want to see a new champion crowned. They want to see an upset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if Sid was the title holder and Shawn was the challenger, the crowd reaction would have been exactly the opposite. And everything that they did was because Shawn was, it didn't have anything to do with him personally, it was just New York. But Shawn was in that state of mind at that time where it was all about him and it was all against him. And he was a pouty, whiny, titty baby.
Do you think it marred his title reign that year? Like, when, just kind of looking back at it, or do you think his work in the ring overshadows it?
I think the work always overshadowed everything that Shawn ever did outside the ring. You know, the fans were unaware of what Shawn was doing. And believe me, I had very little, you know, I had very little negative things to say about Shawn outside the ring. He was much more difficult with others than he was with me. Although he was kind of prickish to me and to a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm.
And Shawn's admitted as such and has apologized for it to many. And you know, I think it's all water under the bridge at this point. We understand where he was in his life, and, you know, we're happy that he's happy now, which is the most important thing. But at the time, I think, did it mar his title reign? I think if you look at it in its totality, it wasn't a great reign, but he wasn't happy with the guys that he had to work with. But could he have gotten more mileage out of Vader and such if he would have been in a better state of mind? Yes, probably.
Yeah, surprises me that he would have been upset with who he was working with. I would argue that, you know, of the recent run of champions at that time frame, he probably had the best guys to work with. It's not like, you know, he had the mess that Diesel had the year before. He worked with, you know, Owen Hart, British Bulldog, Vader, Mick Foley. Yeah, he had a pretty good run there. Dustin Rhodes as Goldust.
I think he really liked working with Goldust.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, they sort of stopped that. They had a couple of really good title matches down in Florida in the summer of 96, and then that was kind of it. It kind of went quietly. I think a lot of it was wrapped up around the Warrior coming back, and that didn't really pan out. And I don't know whether or not Shawn and Warrior was programmed, but was supposed to happen, but didn't. Sid was, if you remember, Sid was sort of the 11th hour answer.
Right.
And after the Warrior, you know, was no longer around. So then Sid instantly elevated to the top spot, and then there you go.
I'm sorry, Scott, one more follow-up on this.
Sure.
Do you think they overshot gunning for the Alamo Dome in early 97 just based on their fan base?
Well, no. I think it was a calculated risk based upon where the company was at the time and the belief that they had a lot of good local sponsorship. Now, the gate wasn't that great, but the building was full.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't as full as widely reported. I think the overall number was less than what they said. But it looked full on TV. And the gate wasn't great, but they had some good local tie-ins and some local sponsors. And it was kind of out-of-the-box thinking because they had a local pay-per-view blackout. And it was kind of interesting in that regard. We did a lot of customization for the San Antonio market. So, you know, it was an aggressive, it was as aggressive as we ever got for anything other than WrestleMania. Mm-hmm.
And kudos to Sean. We will say this, considering he was probably a bit of a pain in the ass in some of those stretches at the end of 96. I mean, he wrestled that match against Sid at the Dome. I mean, he pretty much looked like death warmed over.
Yeah.
And wrestled a 14-minute match against a guy who really could use it, could use the help, and came away with a big win. So kudos to Sean for that.
He was sick as a dog. We got him, he had been dehydrated. We got him Pedialyte, anything we could to just make sure that, because nothing would stay down. Couldn't get any liquid in him either. Everything was coming back up. So just anything to help. And I don't know whether he got it from me or from somebody else, but I had said, well, Pedialyte works. I know that trainers recommend that when you're just, to keep some liquid down so that you don't cramp and you don't, run into difficulties that way. And
right.
He wound up drinking some Pedialyte, and it helped. So, hey,
as long as
he was able to get through it.
There you
saved
go.
The match.
Yes. So we move ahead now to what has now become one of the more famous, I wouldn't even say infamous, famous Raws of that year, and that was, of course, Thursday Raw Thursday from Lowell, Massachusetts. Besides the unbelievably shocking Intercontinental title win for then babyface Rocky Maivia over Mr. Hunter Hearst Helmsley, we had the infamous Shawn Michaels losing my smile speech and forfeiting the World Wrestling Federation Championship. Two things on this, Kevin. Number one, what was the deal? Where did that come about? Was that a Vince thing? Was that a Shawn thing? And B, why give it back to Sid?
Well, again, when you look at who you're going to put it on, you're going to look at what you wanted to do at WrestleMania. Because, again, all signs point to WrestleMania even today.
Mm-hmm.
So who's going to be in the main event of WrestleMania? Were they going to go Shawn Taker? Did Shawn not want to work with Taker? What did Shawn want to do? Did Shawn want to work with Brett? Did he not want to work with Brett? How do we keep it? Well, if we put it on so-and-so, then who is it going to be? So since it became Sid versus Taker and put the belt on Taker at WrestleMania, then Sid was the best opponent for that. So that's why they put it on Sid. I think this was like a week of thing. I don't think this was anything. Who knows? It could have been brewing all through, ever since the Rumble and all the way through. Again, not privy to those conversations. It did kind of come out of left field to all of us. But when it happened, I think there was a collective sigh of relief. And especially when we got to Nashville and did the... that was an exciting Raw.
Yeah, that was a great Raw.
A lot of energy there.
Yes.
And there was a belief that, you know what, we can survive without Shawn.
Mm-hmm.
We can do this. And that was also the night where Vince told Mick Foley as Mankind. I always wondered what Vince thought of Mick. But he said, you're part of the family. You don't have anything to worry about. So that was right at the gorilla position. So that was good to hear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I always had the belief that Vince would look at Nick and go, well, that's not really a Vince McMahon guy.
Right.
You know,
right.
It was a creation, a character that he came up with. So, yeah, but, geez, you know, it's still Cactus Jack, and everybody knows it. And he doesn't exactly look like the kind of guy that Vince would want to see. But that, I think, was the stamp of approval that Nick needed to hear that night. And, you know, again, from there, he went on to incredible heights. And as I wrote about recently in WrestleZone, you know, Mick Foley is a guy who wrestled beyond his ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever limitations he had, athletically, creatively, he always broke through them on his own and was able to push. So don't say it can't be done, because he's an example of, you know, finding a way to get it done.
Right.
So do you know, I know the original match for that Thursday Raw Thursday was for Sid to face Shawn. So I always wondered if, you know, the plan was for Sid just to beat him on that show anyway. And if not, you know, why did they do the whole mess with Brett winning the Final Four just for the one day and then Sid winning it the next night?
Again, what was talked about and what was planned, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how far along in conversation it got. To me, it didn't make sense to beat Shawn at that point.
Right.
Because you had to have Shawn put Brett over. And I think that was what was supposed to happen at WrestleMania.
Okay. Was that supposed to be for the title?
Yeah, okay. Obviously. And yeah. Then Shawn didn't want to do that. And so where were they going to make the change along the way? Since it can't be Shawn versus Bret, how do we get it to be the most logical, well, who are you going to wrestle? Who do you want to face? What do you want to do? And I think maybe it was just decided that he should go away for a while. Perhaps.
So it makes you wonder, too, where, you know, Steve Austin would have wound up in all that, because obviously that ends up becoming a career-making match with Bret Hart, one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time. And you wonder, you know, where would he have fit in if Bret did wrestle Shawn?
I have no idea. Everything, and it's so cliche, but everything does work out for a reason. And I think that that was why part of the belief was is that somehow we can move on. And we don't need Shawn Michaels, and we don't need this one, and we don't need that one. There was a real sense of pride in what, you know, the company was doing at the time. And yeah, we needed to still do some things and make things a little bit more, you know, out of the box thinking, and you know, kind of Vince Russo really helped that along and helped get Vince McMahon into thinking that way.
Mm-hmm.
And just shaking the tree creatively through the course of 97 became one of the biggest things that came out of what was a pretty low rated period if you look back historically.
Which is crazy to think, because as we'll see as we go through the year, it was such a fantastic year quality-wise. Just took the numbers a while to get there. So I want to get into the Raw transition in a minute, but first I want to talk about a very unique Raw, and that was the ECW episode from the Manhattan Center, which I believe was either a week or two after that Nashville Raw. I know half the crew was overseas in Europe, so they had kind of a depleted roster. How did that partnership start with ECW? And any idea why Vince went through with it, and you know what was in it for him besides just filling out a weak card?
I think he always had a soft spot for Heyman, and he had been paying Heyman anyway. He'd been sending Heyman a weekly check for a while, however long ECW was around. So Heyman had helped scout locations for Shotgun Saturday Night, and was doing some, you know, kind of side work for the WWF at the time. And I don't know whether Paul pitched it to Vince. It was, again, it just fit at the right time, and it was, you know, with half the crew overseas, and why not? Let's do it. Let's give it some, you know, let's give it some energy and some validity and see what we can do with it.
Now, obviously particularly during that show and in the couple of Raws after that, Jerry the King Lawler was very vocal in his distaste for ECW. Of course, he penned the awesome expression "extremely crappy wrestling."
Yeah.
Was he just playing it up, or did he legitimately dislike ECW?
I don't think he liked Heyman. I think he disliked Paul Heyman. Going back to when they worked in Memphis together, and Heyman was running him down on the microphone, and then finished up. He had been managing Austin Idol. And so he gave his notice, and I guess he was going to WCW or was going to work with Eddie Gilbert in Alabama, and so Lawler broke his jaw on the way out. Oops. You know, I think that because Austin Idol held up Lawler and Jarrett for money when they did the original Hell in a Cell in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
Austin Idol put up 50 grand of his own money to ensure that he would be there. And if not, $50,000 was going to have to be paid out to the fans. So Idol immediately knew he had Jarrett and Lawler over a barrel.
Right.
So he held him up for money. So he got more money. And I think Lawler never forgot it. I think he partially held Paulie to blame. And that may have been part of it. Again, not 100% sure. That was always just my speculation.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think there was an element of truth and honesty in what the King was saying. But, you know, listen, the King does business with a lot of people that he doesn't like. That's one of the things that makes Jerry Lawler so great, is that he may have true personal distaste and dissatisfaction for somebody, but he can at least compartmentalize that enough to be able to pull off some semblance of business. And that's what they did.
You wonder if that's why he gets along so well with Vince all these years. Very similar in that regard.
Again, there's, you know, it's how you become a survivor.
Right.
Is that you find ways to turn, you know, adversity and to compromise. And what's the best thing for business? And ultimately, what's the best thing for business generally works out good for business. You know, you never hear that phrase, we did what was good for business, and it turned out to be the worst thing for business.
Right,
right.
You know, what is best for business generally turns out that way. So, and that's why, you know, I think, you know, Heyman got certainly, now, I think we were helping promote their pay-per-view, or we were helping facilitate get them on pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember 100%. Well, I think there was, because a lot of that was shrouded in secrecy.
Right.
You know, because while we were having profit improvability meetings, and Vince and Linda were telling us, and rightfully so, that they had lost $5 million, we were wondering why they were paying Heyman like a grand or $1,500 a week.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah, it is a unique, you know, thing for him to forge a partnership at that time. So maybe he was just trying to find, you know, WCW had a lot of partnerships around the country, so maybe he figured he should get in on one while he can, but... it worked because of the area and the tie CCW. I mean, that was a hot little feud they had going on. And I think the anger, whether it was real or not, with Lawler and Heyman was a big part of that. That really made it feel realistic. And they definitely were plugging the pay-per-view. They did it a lot in those few weeks. And also around the time, and this can kind of bring us into talking about Ken Shamrock, they were plugging UFC a lot as well. They had a working relationship with them, it seemed. Do you know if that was that part of the Shamrock deal to bring him in? Was that they would plug the show, or was it just
coincidence? I think that was part of the deal, is that they would plug the UFC pay-per-view in order to be able to get some access to the footage and also to have Shamrock work while he may still have been under a UFC contract.
What were your thoughts of Shamrock coming in? It seemed like you picked things up fairly quickly from a fan perspective.
Well, yeah, and he was trained as a professional wrestler. He was a great guy that fit in instantly from the minute he walked in.
Mm-hmm.
He was a veteran who had, even though he came in from having fought in UFC, he had that pro wrestler mentality and knew exactly how to say it, what to say it. Needed a little bit of work just on, you know, promos and things like that, but overall had it right away, and there was, again, you'd think some guys might walk in, like when Dan Severn walked in, he kind of rubbed people the wrong way just from his attitude, just from Dan kind of being Dan, but Shamrock's a very likable, good-natured kind of guy.
That's good.
Except when he snaps, and then he goes, and then beats people up.
And that's where he turned the corner later in the year, because before that, he was just kind of like a silent assassin kind of guy, and he didn't really have a hook to him. But when he started doing the whole snapping thing and beating up all the refs, that kind of put him over. He was definitely one of my favorites during that time period. I really like Shamrock, so I'm glad to hear my feelings were validated a bit. But
so we move on now. Probably, in my opinion, the whole issue with ECW, I think, kind of got into the WWF's heads that maybe Raw needed a little bit of a cosmetic refresh. And thus we have the new Raw, which would debut in mid-March. Gone is the big letters and the small venue. Well, not small venues, not the venues that look as small anymore. And now you got this big tight, you know, the big Titantron, the new screen and the ramp. Big ramp, yeah. and so much different stuff. Where did that come from, Kev? Who's you know, obviously then the show expanded to 2 hours and everything. Where did that idea come from to kind of refresh the cosmetic part of the show, and what was the feeling backstage about having kind of a new atmosphere in the workplace, if you will?
I think it all came from the TV studio. I don't know whether or not the TV studio, Kevin Dunn led studio, I don't know whether or not they went to Vince and said, hey, we have an idea. Or Vince said, you guys have any ideas? Because I know David Sahadi was very much behind this, and Chris Chambers and Kevin Dunn. It was a unified presentation belief that this was something that, you know, because at the same time they released the campaign of, wasn't it when they did Larry King spoofs on WCW?
Yes, yep.
So that was kind of all wrapped around that. Excuse me. And the, the TV studio was heavily involved, and the Raw is war theme, and shooting the new open, and it was like, whoa, this is drastically different,
yeah.
And very exciting, and I don't care what they do, I like this better.
Yeah, I mean, as a fan, it just came out of completely out of left field. Just all of a sudden, you know, we go from being in the Manhattan Center 1 week to, being in this arena with this crazy look. And, do you know if USA played a part? It's always kind of been the word out there that USA kind of went to them, too, and basically gave them the money to help do this.
It could have been. Again, Vince has always had, you know, WWE's always had a great partnership with USA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I can't remember the woman's name now.
Bonnie Hammer.
Bonnie Hammer, yes.
Yeah, Bonnie Hammer.
Big fan. And again, was there investment from USA? Wouldn't surprise me. We didn't see who wrote the check. We just liked the new stage and the big Titantron.
Yeah, it just added a bigger feel to the show. So I thought it was well done. And of course, one of the most memorable episodes, you know, early on from that new set came a couple weeks later when they had the big steel cage match. With Bret Hart going for the title, and they had Undertaker and Austin in a fair, and at the end was kind of the first real hints of the new attitude that was seeping in, where Bret shoved Vince down, was beating up Pat Patterson, and swore on air, and they had it beeped out, and it was kind of chaos. In your eyes, was that the kind of the first? Okay, here we go. We're getting off the mat, and now we're really coming out swinging with this kind of product.
I think at that point, Vince was sort of putting his toe in the water. He may not have been all in, but I think he was all in as soon as his ass hit the deck. And he looked up and he saw, I think he liked how that felt. I think he liked the energy. I think he liked the chaos. And the more out of control it got, the better Vince liked it. Everything was, again, not as carefully scripted as it is today. But again, it was, let's do this, and then let's do this. And it all just seemed to work out without it being, okay, then you will turn and you will look at me and you will say this, and right. I will say this back to you, you know.
Yeah, no kidding.
Instead, it just felt real, and there's a live camera on somebody's shoulder, and it's shooting all this action, and we don't know what's going to happen next.
So we get into Chicago. March 23rd, 1997. And we have one of the most epic, as JR mentioned, matches in the history of the business with Bret and Stone Cold. And then there's not a bad main event. Undertaker and Sid was about as good as it could have been. Other than that, that show just comes off very plain. For WrestleMania.
And why is that? Because Raw is war.
Mm-hmm.
That was where Raw became bigger than WrestleMania. That was where the television show superseded. I went to the building that day and I said, this feels like a Raw, except like a taped Raw,
right.
Not even a live one. You know, it just felt like, because at the time we were doing one live, one tape, it just felt like blah. And it was WrestleMania.
Right.
And I think even, like I said it to Michael Hayes or somebody like that, and he's like, yeah, you're right. It just kind of feels blah, you know? It just wasn't anything. And this was, again, at the time where they were maximizing every dollar. Because when you go to an arena and you set up that stage, you're killing 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 seats maybe. Yeah, you don't want to do that with WrestleMania, especially in the Allstate Arena. It's an 18,000-seat building to begin with. Now it's 15 with kills. Holy crap, it's WrestleMania. You just cost me $500,000, pal. So we've got to make sure that we were maximizing every dollar, and that's why the pay-per-view sets evolved slowly over time, because they were still, drawing-wise, they were still selling a lot of tickets. We want to make sure we minimized our kills, and so the sets were scaled down as compared to Raw. But a byproduct of that was that you didn't have the big event feel.
And I think maybe part of it, too, is that, you didn't get to see the set ahead of time, so that feel doesn't really affect the show until you've already hooked everyone into paying anyway. So that's probably part of it. They're probably like, well, you know what, no one's going to buy this. You know, on Raw, you may tune in because you see the look, but you're not going to, if you pay for Mania, you're not going to tune out, probably.
Nobody's, right, that was exactly, nobody's buying the pay-per-view for the set. Well, okay, yeah, but again, what's the perception? You know?
Right, exactly.
What's the perception? And so I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen that evolve over time.
And even, go Scott.
I was going to say, just to piggyback that, and a lot of people now look forward to the WrestleMania set when we talk about sets. I mean, we see the early shots, particularly this year down at Miami, and the set was crazy. And then, but back then,
they're in a different spot financially now.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. But back then, you're dealing with selling seats. That's the key thing.
But that Mania as a whole, Kevin, just even taking the atmosphere out of it, just from a card perspective, and I know the talent pool is a little bit shallow at that point. It just felt like it was the weirdest, a very weird card as far as match assembly goes. Like, they had kind of weird pairings. You had Vader and Mankind teaming against Bulldog and Owen, which was weird, and you had that odd kind of four way tag match, and you had Rocky Maivia, who was didn't have much heat at all as champion, taking on the Sultan of all people. And outside of the two big matches and the Nation six man thing, but outside of that, there just really wasn't much there. I mean, it just felt like it sticks out like a sore thumb to me, in a run of really good TV shows.
And again, that may have been part of the reason why that show kind of felt a little flat, is that other than the Austin Bret Hart match, which, as JR said, is epic and exactly right, and is now one of the most stolen finishes you see everywhere, right? And I think if you mention, Bret Hart, Steve Austin, what's the first image? Oh, Austin trapped in the sharpshooter with blood spurting out of his head.
Right.
Ding, ding, ding. Mm-hmm. And that came from WrestleMania 13, which, other than that, and Ron Simmons almost killing the French announce team for a shoot with the real live shoot fire extinguisher.
Yes, that's right.
What do you mean it's not CO2?
I can't believe it wasn't Ahmed Johnson that almost killed him.
Yeah, really.
Poor Ahmed Johnson. I'm going to kick you in the kidney. Oh, no, I kicked you in the kidney for real.
What's your take on Ahmed? Let's sidetrack for a minute, because he's kind of become a hot button on our podcast.
Oh, Ahmed, bless his heart.
Yeah.
He was so, he tried hard. Vince said to me, I was getting ready to do an interview with him, and he said, if Ahmed doesn't get to the point, just, get him back on point, get him in the office, give him a little squeeze. Okay. And, so I go out there, and Ahmed's doing his thing, and he's not making any sense, and I'm squeezing his arm, and still not making any sense. Squeezing his arm again, still not making any sense, and finally that was pretty much it. And I go back through the curtain. Vince says, told you to get in the office. I did, Vince. I'm squeezing the hell out of his arm. What do you want from me? Never mind. It's all right.
Maybe you couldn't feel it.
I'm begging him, please, wrap it up. Take it home. Flipping my tie, anything I could.
Shaking the keys.
Shaking the keys out of waving.
What are you...
I brought Mr. Coffee in from Memphis. Come on, Mr. Coffee, get out of here. No, Mr. Coffee, let him wrestle some more. That's another sidetrack story. Anyway.
Let's get it. You want to tell it?
Just that Mr. Coffee, would be send the guys home, come out and flip his tie or whatever. And if they weren't paying attention to him, he'd come out and kind of walk down further the aisle away from the, and fans would get smart to it after that. I'll leave below, Mr. Coffee, let him wrestle.
Was that your best Bruno Lauer impression? We had him on the
show
a few weeks ago.
Don't make fun of my Memphis impression.
Okay.
Anytime you want to get Bruno Lauer on the show, man, he's awesome.
We had him. We did a two-part interview. He was great.
He's incredible.
Yeah,
he's very good.
He was really good. Yeah, he was. Yeah. Just going back to Ahmed for a second, though, do you think if he didn't have that kidney injury, he would have lasted or done better? Because, he was rolling before that thing really derailed him. Or do you think it was only a matter of time?
It just seemed like he was... again, what was his ceiling? Where was his peak? And he was right there at it. No, I don't think he would have gone much further. I think he was exactly what he was at the time, and he was exactly what he was supposed to be at the time. Water finds its own level, and he found it.
Hmm. Now, we get out of Mania. Well, one thing about Mania, which I mentioned, that ended up being a high point was, of course, the Bret and Stone Cold match and the finish, and of course the double turn. Stone Cold, the empathetic bleeding warrior who fought till his very last breath before passing out, and Bret, who couldn't stand the change and started stomping, and Shamrock tried to get him off him, and it was the heel turn was almost complete, and then he really turned it on the next night on Raw. Is that the way it was supposed to come off? How did it feel backstage? when that was executed, is that exactly what everyone was looking for, or did that almost come as a surprise?
Nope, that was exactly what everybody wanted. Hmm. That was exactly what was supposed to happen. So it was perfect for a lot of reasons, and mainly I always thought that it was Brett doing that for Steve as well. Mm-hmm. Brett knowing that Steve was the guy and that Steve had it. And so many guys, you know, don't want, and it doesn't happen that much, but, you know, you hear stories about guys not wanting to do business and not wanting to help the other guy get over, and that was certainly not the case with Brett.
And I think a big part of that turn that helped it along were two other players. I thought Ken Shamrock as the ref really made things feel like legitimate instead of just another ref in there. He really felt like someone that could get in there and, you know, mix it up with them if he had to. It made it feel like a real fight. And also Vince McMahon, to me, that's his peak as a commentator. I thought he was phenomenal during that match. And without him, I don't know if that whole thing gets over as well as it did.
That was where you really blurred the line between Vince as the owner, Vince as the commentator, the partisan. You know, that was kind of where it all came to be. And the fact that he wound up basically doing a 180 on Austin in a year, you know, less than a year, mm-hmm. to me was remarkable.
That's it. Any other follow-ups there?
No, that's it. I was just going to go. Yeah, from there, of course, then we go into the next couple weeks on Raw where the Hart Foundation storyline develops. You have Brett reuniting with Owen and Davey Boy. Was that all Brett, that one?
I don't know. I mean, it probably was. I think a lot of the things with Brett, a lot of the things with the top guys,
mm-hmm.
you know, Vince's top four, top five, let's say, and that list evolves over time. Vince's focus is on those guys. And then the other folks, the Pat Pattersons and Bruce Pritchards or the Vince Russos or the team of Hollywood flunky buffoon losers that he has now, they're to write for everything else. So Vince is very hands-on with kind of the top guy stuff. And then the blanks are filled in around that. So I'm sure it was he and Brett. I'm sure it was Pat and Brett. I think it was a combination of a lot of different things. And obviously Brett wouldn't sign on to do anything that he didn't agree with, as
right.
he had creative control in his contract. And so, yeah, that was from him, and that then led to what we did in July, which was really good business in Calgary. So
yeah, we'll get there definitely in a few minutes. But so they kept the titles on Bulldog and Owen, you know, probably just for that feud, obviously, to make it, you know, heavier. What did you think as a fan of that whole thing? Do you think it was shrewd? I mean, I you know, ends up obviously being one of the greatest storylines of all time. Did you see it coming out of the gate? Did you know it was going to work from that first Owen Hart smirk or Bret Hart smirk while Owen was crying and they weren't embracing?
It was, you know, having the privilege of knowing what's up versus being able to see it unfold live and mm-hmm. not really knowing what's up, two different things. But being able to see, you know, the little detail and the little nuance and how it's executed and how it comes across, to me, that's what really made it special. That's one of those examples there where you almost would like to just be the fan at home and not have no idea what you're about to see as you turn on the television that night. But to see it the way it was done, it was like, wow, this was good. But it just seemed like a natural reset. It seemed like, you know, this is what the people want, and put Davey and Owen and Brett all...
Scott, you with me?
I'm with you.
I think we lost Kevin. Kevin, are you there? Still on the call.
I see. I wonder if... Nope, he's not on the call anymore.
Well, I just dropped him.
Oh, okay.
Let's try and get him back, and hopefully it wasn't his power that went out. Good stuff so far, though.
Tremendous. I like the that was a great analysis by him involving Heyman and Lawler. That's a lot of good stuff that I... Because, you know, to me, Heyman's a lot like...
Actually, hang on 1 second. Scotty's calling me, so 1 second. Okay, and we are back with Kevin. It was a quick power surge. You don't even know what the things were going through for your nation to get this interview to you. It's been weeks of food poisoning and storms and everything else. So presidential debates.
I, again, we start to talk about the Hart family, you know what I mean? And that's when we get zapped. You know?
Yeah, we get ribbed.
It's an Owen rib. This whole storm is one big, gigantic Owen rib. Yes.
Yes.
But as I was saying, the you know, it felt natural to put the Hart Foundation back together, and I think that this was part of that creative reset that they were doing. It wasn't all at once. It wasn't come out on TV and strip all the champions, but it was slowly bring everybody back to where they felt like they should be.
Mm-hmm.
And allowing, again, where's the playing field? Who are our top guys? And how do we book cards and pay-per-views that are going to draw money? And I think, again, no matter what you do in wrestling, if you're looking at what are the best matchups, why does UFC work? Because these are the best matchups. If I put this guy versus this guy, then it's the best match possible. And if I pair these two guys with this guy and this guy, now I've got two different kinds of fights that I can sell. And it's the same thing with wrestling. When wrestling works at its best is you have a list of names on a page, you put them in the most logical fashion so that when they blend together, you create a card of matchups that people want to pay money to see.
And now, the unique thing about that whole story as well was the whole split of having, you know, Bret Hart be a face around the world and a heel in the United States and have him act completely. Yeah, I think what made that story so great was that he never deviated from his thoughts from when he returned in November until, you know, throughout the summer. You know, it did become a little hypocritical in some spots, but he pretty much kept speaking the same message that whole time. And they twirled it so that it was Austin and the U.S. fans that had turned on him. And it was just so well done. It was just so smart and unique to the time.
And again, completely accidental.
Mm-hmm.
And a benefit of pure scheduling fortune.
Right. I mean,
because we never ran in the United States on holidays like Memorial Day or Labor Day and the 4th of July. So you had opportunities to go to Canada, which is where they logically went, because they weren't going to Europe or anything from at the end of 96 on. We only did the paid tour in Kuwait, and that was it.
And the wasn't the South Africa? No, was it South Africa or Germany? There was one other one.
There was a Germany, Kuwait, right. South Africa thing, and then that was it. Those were paid gigs.
Okay.
That was not us booking a tour. That was like a paid thing through, well, whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway,
yeah.
So from that point on, it was North America. And just being able to go in Canada and see how the Canadian fans would take the Bret made that story all the more rich and the meal complete. Because then you'd come back, and it was the exact same thing being said.
Right.
And the exact opposite reaction.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was just, you know, there's that one stretch in, like, July where it was like every other week they were either in Canada or the U.S., and it was just crazy. You know, week to week, it was just complete different atmosphere, and just it kept things fresh. Nothing got stale. It was like you couldn't wait for the 2 weeks to go by to get back to the U.S., and then I'm sure the Canadian fans were dying for them to get back to Canada, and it was just very unique and very very fun.
And that was it was in one of those Canadian shows, Nova Scotia or Newfoundland or one of those places in the Maritimes, where Jim Cornette called Kevin Dunn a this is the internet, right?
Yes, you can do whatever you and say whatever you want.
He said where he called Kevin Dunn Bucky Beaver motherfucker, which was one of the greatest insults of all time. Cornette in, you know, that may be stamped on Kevin Dunn's tombstone one day. because it summarized the feelings that not only Jim had but many of us had for that little evil bastard.
So with the change in Raw cosmetically came the change in Raw, obviously, with the booking and the meat and potatoes. And you mentioned Kevin earlier about Vince Russo. He, of course, was rising up the booking ladder. How did he impress Vince? What got him to that level of
there was the week after Raw did a 1-7. Early in 97?
I think it was a South Africa show.
Yeah, that was it. Vince had a meeting in his office and basically said, I've had all I can stands and I can't stands no more. Who's got ideas? And Vince Russo was the first, you know, so Bruce, Pat, Cornette, Jim Ross, maybe a couple of other people were there. And Vince Russo stood up and said, I have some ideas, and basically used Raw Magazine as an idea of Well, this is kind of what we're talking about here in this magazine, and this is what I think we could start doing on the show. Basically, shooting with the fans, being honest with them, no bullshit. You know, edgy, push the envelope, et cetera, et cetera. And since he was a guy with, you know, more balls than brains, and he stood up in a meeting where he probably should have sat down and kept his mouth shut, he stood up and spoke his mind, wound up fashioning a pretty good career for himself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where he really earned his trust.
And so it was from there that he was immediately put to the head of the team, or was he just added to the mix?
No, added to the mix,
okay.
Working with Cornette, and Cornette then, over time, hated living in the Northeast and hated Vince Russo and wanted to get away. And so basically, at the time we were launching the developmental company, well, go back to Louisville, Jim, and help run OVW.
Right.
Thank God. So, you know, so it was sort of a war of attrition.
Right. And it was a big move to put him in, and it really, you know, because he had the cosmetic changes already, but like Scott said.
Right. Pat moved back to Florida.
Okay.
Pat Patterson didn't live in Connecticut anymore, so that was one more. And then, so it was Russo and Bruce, and then Bruce, I think, something happened where Jim Ross, can't remember. Anyway, so it wound up not being Bruce, then it was just Russo and Vince for a very short period of time, and then they hired Ed Ferrar.
Hmm.
And, of course, that duo would explode by 98.
And
yes.
What did they do? They fed Vince McMahon with good ideas.
Yep.
And that was it. It wasn't that these two revolutionized the wrestling business.
No.
Because you saw what happened when they went to WCW.
Yes.
And that we could talk for hours about.
Yes, we can.
They threw good coal into the furnace. And we got a red hot fire.
Yep.
So another unique idea. I'm sorry, Scott. Did you have a follow up?
No, go ahead. Okay. No, I'm fine.
Another unique idea at this time was to take two characters that had a very old school feel to them and start to bring out their inside personality and really develop them. And that was Goldust and Mankind. And they did the sit down interviews with Jim Ross. You know, I think Goldust was up first, and they basically finally revealed that he was Dustin Rhodes, and he talks about, you know, his issues with his father, and that Marlene is his wife, and they have a daughter, and all this stuff. And then the Mankind ones, which were really, you know, really well done and really memorable, where they show the footage of him as a kid jumping off the roof, and, you know, all the ECW and all the Japanese deathmatch footage, and, you know, really added to his, you know, the depth to his persona as well. What did you think of those interviews? If you have any, you know, behind the scenes kind of thoughts on them, but even just again, as you know, an onlooker, did you think it was another step in the right direction?
That was what we were doing with Raw Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I was the managing editor of the publications, and I came to be the managing editor of the publications because Vince Russo hired me, and I told the story last time about how they were ready to let me go, and basically. They said, Kevin Dunn said, oh, I don't want Kevin anymore. He's lazy. I really don't like him. And Russo was writing TV with Vince McMahon, and McMahon was on speakerphone, and McMahon kind of looked down his glasses like, what? Really? And Russo was like, I'll take him. I want him to work with me in the magazines. And so that was it. So I started working in the magazines and eventually got hired back to work for TV, so it wound up being fine. But that was what we were doing with Raw Magazine. We were telling shoot stories, and we weren't exposing the business necessarily, but we were just stripping away some of the fakeness, just the fakeness of the persona that everybody knew was fake,
mm-hmm.
and allow these fictional characters to be real. And there's a difference. They were still larger than life fictional characters, but we were just presenting them now in a real fashion. And look at the depth and dimension that we gave to Mick Foley out of that. And Dustin, I don't know what... I think Dustin was very conflicted at the time, and I don't know whether or not he ever could get, you know, all of the... Yeah, a lot of things going on emotionally, and he's a very emotional guy. So, but I thought that what they did with him was great. Obviously, the one with Mick was the... I never liked the end of the Mick one where
yes.
He gave Jim Ross the mandible claw. I hated that.
Made no sense.
It just came off gimmicky.
And it was like, you know, they did such a good job. You're almost basically turning him face through these interviews, and then you have him do that.
I think that was the idea.
Right.
We're telling this sympathetic story. And then how do you boo the guy? Well, you have him attack Jim Ross, which became a tragic theme over the years.
Yes,
that is true. So we get to June, and we get to what conceivably, you obviously had to start booking who your King of the Ring winner was going to be. And the card that was being put together was starting to look really great. And mm-hmm. and JR can attest more to this because he went to this show. And then as it evolved, devolved, the card went from being really, really good to really, really not so great. First off, two questions. How far in advance was Helmsley picked as the winner? And B, why did the undercard change so often? And do you think it set back the product at the time?
What were the final matches? I don't remember.
It was Farouk versus The Undertaker. And originally, from the local ads we had here in Providence, like dating back to like May, it was supposed to be Undertaker. The original card, I remember, was supposed to be like Undertaker and Ahmed Johnson. And then Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels in like that 10-minute challenge. And Pillman and Austin. It was supposed to be Pillman's first match back. And then everything changed. It ended up being Austin and Michaels. And Bret and Pillman were off the show. And then we get that awful, awful Undertaker-Farouk match on there.
Well, was Pillman still hurt at the time?
No, because I think he wrestled 2 weeks later. He finally had the match with Austin on Raw. Well, it would have been maybe like even, I don't know if they were taping at that point, but it was either a couple days later or a week later.
I think he wasn't ready.
Okay.
I think it was a question of him being ready, and obviously Sean and Bret didn't want to work with each other.
And I think Bret was injured too. He was coming off that knee, getting his knee cleaned up.
Yeah. And, you know, Sean-Austin match was great.
Yes.
That wound up being fantastic.
Mm. Ending was a little
strange.
Wasn't
that where Taker burned Paul Bearer?
No, that was when he fought Mankind.
That was Revenge of the Taker.
That was May?
April.
Or April.
April, yeah.
April.
Yeah, this was King of the Ring was the whole thing where Paul Bearer was back to managing him with the Secret.
Right.
That would, of course, end up being... We all know what the Secret ended up being. Yeah. We'll get to that
in a
second.
That's what I mean. It was the greatest Secret ever.
Right.
Yeah.
Too bad the match wasn't the greatest match ever. Him and Farouk.
Yeah. listen. What do you want?
Hey, I paid good money to go to that show. I didn't want to see a 20-minute, you know, Farouk slopping around the ring with, a chin lock on Undertaker. That's why I didn't want
Hang
to see
Hang on now. You got to see Shawn Michaels.
I know.
Versus Stone Cold Steve Austin.
I know, Kevin.
And you got on camera.
Providence, Rhode Island.
I did get
Island.
On camera. Hey. What's wrong with Providence? We just had one of your great Ring of Honor shows a few months ago.
The Friendly Tap. I know. We used to be the friend. Did you come to the Providence show?
I did not. I was away. You had it on the wrong weekend. I had already booked a hotel.
Yeah, that's my fault. Now it's my fault.
Yes. Well, you kind of blew me off. You were last time we talked about it. You're like, oh, yeah, maybe we'll talk if you come. And so I was like, I'm not going to bother you.
How far back, to the other half of the question, Kevin, how far back was the choice to have Helmsley win the tournament?
Oh, God, you're going to get your Helmsley question in.
Of course I do.
I know, he's got a shoehorn that thing in.
Oh, he's
Wasn't
obsessed.
He supposed to win it the year before?
Yes, I think so.
Yes, he was the only curtain call punishment.
Obviously.
Yes.
Obviously it was then.
Yep.
They were going to see whether or not he was, he would take his punishment, and he did.
Mm. He definitely did.
So it went back over a year. And that was that. And it was great that it happened that way. Because it fueled the fire of DX, and that promo where he said basically he was held down, he was held back, blah, 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 blah. That was half a shoot, That's what made it so good. Die, Rocky, die. That promo fueled those chants and those signs that night in Lowell in 1997 fueled the greatest turn and was born the biggest star in sports entertainment history.
I think it's amazing
and
when you
say nothing good comes out of Lowell. I heard you say that before.
Who, me or Scott?
You said it.
No, I didn't say
and
it.
And listen to you now. Look at you.
It's amazing if you look at those 3-year stretch from like 96 to like 98, how many little things led to so many big things later on. Like the curtain call led to the, birth of DX basically with having the anger, like you said, and it also inadvertently led to Steve Austin winning the King of the Ring and launching him. And it's just, there's so many little things that if they didn't go the way they did, so much stuff would have changed.
Exactly right. That's what made it. That's why when you script everything to death, you beat the life out of it.
Right.
You know? If you follow the recipe verbatim and you don't cook from the heart, the meal is never as good. But if you throw things in a pan that you know work together and you trust your instincts and you put just the right temperature on it and you leave it on for just the right amount of time, you know when it's ready and you know that it's good. But if you make somebody follow a recipe, never turns out as good.
It's beautiful.
That's wrestling in a nutshell. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's all wrestling is. It's a meal. And a card is the multiple courses of the meal. And the match has all the different flavors, from the sweet and savory and salt and spice. And when you get all of that together and you finish at the end of the meal and you put your napkin back down on your plate, you go, my gosh, I'm so satisfied. That's the feeling that a wrestling fan has when they leave an arena.
True. I think it's a good analogy.
Excellent. Excellent analogy. Getting out of King of the Ring, then.
Actually, Scott, I wanted to backtrack. There's two things I wanted to talk about that weren't on our list. One is, Kevin, just give us your thoughts quickly on the awesome episode of Raw with the Bret Hart, Steve Austin street fight that ended with the ambulance, you know, him beating him up in the ambulance and then the return of Pillman and all that stuff.
Well, that was just, that was crazy, chaotic, a lot of fun. Again, often imitated, many times duplicated since then. But that was really like, this is live TV. This is when, you know, we better get these shots right. And it was just, it was a lot of, you know, the atmosphere and the intensity was there. And I remember Pillman's ankle was not good.
Right.
Because he was hobbling quickly into the dressing room off to the side.
Right.
I was one that was there just to make sure that he got through the curtain clean without being, you know, attacked. And he got through, and all right, Brian, you all right? You all right? You all right? And he was not all right. He was in agony. So
what led to him coming back at that point? I mean, was he just like, screw it, I'm not going to get any better, or did they force him back into things?
No, I don't think they ever forced him. I think it was just his own, he was going to will himself to do it.
Yeah.
You know, because again, what they wanted to do in Calgary was the Hart Foundation match. He wanted to be a part of it. He wanted to work with Steve. So he was never going to get any better. And it was what it was. So he just needed to work through it, work around it as best he can, but it obviously was never right. And that was, you know, I saw it firsthand, and it was tough to watch.
Do you, I mean, I personally think that Austin being in the ambulance is one of the greatest, like, surprise payoffs of all time in wrestling history, when they pan up and he's got the driver hanging out of the window by his tie, and then he comes out, and of course, Owen yelling, watch his knee, and all that stuff. I mean, to me, that was just one of the greatest scenes in wrestling history.
Again, that's one of those little details that you don't tell Owen Hart to say that.
Right.
Owen just does. And those little details. Again, like I said before, not to sound like the broken record, you can't script those things. Mm-hmm. You just rely on the talent to get the segment over. And that's what happens.
Unless they call gunshots explosions, then you wish you scripted it, right?
Yeah, right. Why did I say that? Why can I not think of this word? Craziness.
Oh, man. So the other thing I wanted to backtrack on was, of course, Shawn Michaels back in the fold by this point. The knee injury miraculously healed. Did you ever buy any of that or no?
No.
Okay.
For a second.
Yeah. So what was the thought putting him with, you know, they had the tag team, they win the tag titles, him and Austin. Did they see that going anywhere? I mean, you know, Shawn, and that was what Scott was going to lead to next, was him getting into the big fight with Bret and leaving again. But did they see him, you know, sticking around? Obviously they did, but, you know, was that kind of the plan, him and Austin to be, you know, frenemies, basically?
I think that, who, Austin and Michaels?
Yes.
I think the idea was they really enjoyed working with each other in the match in June, and that Shawn might be a little happier if he's working with Steve, and Steve was happy to work with Shawn because he knew he was going to have good matches, and as a tag they were, you know, energized. And but I think at that point Steve started to maybe get a little protective of his spot, start to realize where he was. So I think he knew that he was going to be the top guy, And where it wound up with them at WrestleMania the following March was really emblematic of that. It was not Shawn Michaels' show anymore. It was the Stone Cold show, and it was the Stone Cold Steve Austin show in 97 as well.
So what was it like? I mean, this took place, getting back to the battle between Brett and Shawn. I mean, that took place in Hartford, one of my home bases for my shows. What was going on? I mean, how did that start? I mean, who stopped it? Who got in the middle of it?
I forget where I was. I was doing a magazine interview somewhere in the arena with someone, I can't remember, and walked back into the backstage area. It's like, what the hell is going on? What did I miss? Oh, my God, Brett and Shawn just got in a fight. Oh, you're kidding me. These two, I swear, what are they, children? And there was a big clump of somebody's hair on the floor. I didn't know whether it was Brett or Shawn's. And so then you go through, kind of the first little locker room area, and then you see where what was the TV locker room, and that was where I had my bag. And so I put my recorder and stuff away, and then that was where the clump of hair was. And I go out in the hallway, and, Shawn's got his shirt off, and he's doing the Fred Sanford thing, and Brett's somewhere else, and they send Shawn home, sent Brett home and kept Shawn. I can't remember what they did, but it was like, really? You guys are grown men. Why are you acting like children? So.
And
teams always like that. That always gets the boys all whooped up.
Right.
They love that stuff.
It
allows them to pick sides and tell stories about who is the bigger bitch.
And, from the stories you hear, and who knows if it's, spun by Brett or not, but it seemed like the majority were, had Brett's back outside of Shawn's, closest friends, but
there was a significant Brett faction. There was a smaller Shawn faction, and then there was a faction of, really, seriously,
yeah,
they're fighting over Sonny. Can we stop?
Right,
just move on.
So was that the real genesis of all this?
Oh, who knows what the genesis of it was, but it was an element of it.
Right,
you know what I mean? And really. Who cares?
We laugh because we watched a couple weeks ago, we reviewed Wrestling with Shadows, and Brett goes out of his way to talk about how him and Sonny were just friends, and it just comes off as like really guilty and trying to cover something up. So Shawn went away, left for a few weeks, comes back all kind of smug and arrogant and bragging about his new, multi-million dollar deal and his brand new house and everything else. And there were a lot of rumors at the time that he wanted to get out of his contract to go join the NWO. Was that ever close to happening,
No, it was not.
Okay.
In fact, after Shawn went away after WrestleMania, Vince said that he was willing to pay Shawn Michaels whatever it was he was making, 15 grand a week, just as a way of saying thank you for all he had done, which was really code for I'm not letting him out of his contract so he can mysteriously, clean himself up and wind up on WCW.
Now, we get to a moment, and you mentioned this earlier in the show, probably one of the best overall pay-per-views of all time, just based on quality and excitement and emotion, and that's, of course, Canadian Stampede up in Calgary. Many consider the last true great moment of the Hart family. Talk about the memories of that show, being up there, being with the fans, how the card was, because for a show that only had, four matches...
Mm-hmm.
There were four great matches. You had the awesome Foley-Helmsley brawl. You had Sasuke and Taka. You had even Vader-Taker was really good. And then, of course, the 10-man. What were your memories of that day in Calgary?
Well, a few things. First of all, Sasuke was supposed to earn his job, basically prove to Vince that he could work. Vince had never seen him before. brought over Taka, his young boy, and Taka was going to make it look like $1 million, and instead it was Taka that wound up stealing the shine from his teacher and got the job. Then, of course, this was one event that I was not at. because this was after my whole contract thing. I had stopped being on TV for a little bit, and then they put me back on TV like a few months later.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't at this one, but I had the ability to watch this one as a fan. And what a treat, because it gave me the chance to see the whole, you know, I think the 10-man, I think this was probably one of the easiest shows to put together, because it was the Hart family and everybody that liked working with them, and just go out there and have fun and give us a spectacular main event in front of a really appreciative home crowd. And probably the hardest working people there were backstage crew, making sure that all the Hart family didn't overrun the place and making sure that everybody had their tickets so that they could, you know, sit and watch this match. Other than that, it was, I think, pretty simple. And that's why that show was so damn good.
Almost like a match you see at a house show, where they just kind of went out and did it for the crowd, not for, you know, a larger audience.
Exactly. And, I mean, Austin was on fire. That was where Austin was at his dead level best, you know, and everything changed for him 1 month later. But, you know, he moved like that was his finest moment physically, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, why did he do that? Why? Did he do it because he wanted to show off? No, because he did it because he wanted to be the most recognized guy in a 10-man match. How do you do that? Sometimes you got to go a little faster. You got to work a little harder, you know? And that's a parable for life. That's what I took from that match. Austin's working his ass off here because he wants to show everybody that he is the top guy and that he deserves this spot that he's earning. And no matter the circumstance, he's gonna get the shine here, and he did.
The I had a point now, but that story was so good, I kind of I forgot. Oh, the U.S.
Yes.
team. Do you know if that changed originally? Because it seemed like an odd mix of guys, and you would think that, you know, maybe Sean was supposed to be in there, or maybe even Sid, or, you know, the Patriot came in a couple weeks later, or it just Shamrock and Goldust. This seemed like odd choices to be in that match.
Again, I don't think it really mattered.
Right.
You know, Hearts were up that night, so it didn't really matter just who was going to take the fall and how was it going to lead into what we saw the next month.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't need to do any setup with Brett and Taker. We didn't need to do any. We've already done enough with, you know, with Sean and the Hart family. If you would have put Sean in that mix, they would have been, you know, they would have burned the building to the ground.
Right.
So it overshadows the match.
Yep.
So you put those elements in there, and Shamrock was close with the Hart family, so I think he wanted to be in there. And they had a lot of respect for Dustin, so he was in there. You know, there wasn't anybody by accident that was in there.
Okay. Yeah, it just seemed like Goldust to me was just the weirdest one, because he was in that big feud with Helmsley, and then all of a sudden, you know, he's out there feuding with the Harts. But like you said, I'm sure, obviously, there's a reason for it. But so coming off of that, Raw at this time was just very random, very odd. You'd see random light heavyweights come in and fight, and then you had guys masquerading as light heavyweights, like the old Fantastics. They came in and fought a match, and you had, you know, various indie guys like Brian Christopher would show up, and Chris Candido, and they seemed to be trying a lot of different things that they hadn't done ever before. And it was just, you know, it was cool. It was just something different. You know,
how do you get new guys over? You introduce them one at a time, and you put them in in a tournament and a feature, and you let it evolve over week after week.
Yep.
That was really it. Jim Cornette booked all those guys.
Okay. So it was
why the wrestling was good.
True. So was it just something where they were like, you know, let's see what sticks kind of thing? It's you know, week after week. Because it seemed like every week was something different. And a lot of guys didn't show up again. Like Sabu was on 1 week, and then he didn't show up again. Candido. You know, these guys would come in a lot of times for one shot.
Well, that was an ECW thing.
Right.
The guys that were picked to kind of stick around were Scott Taylor and Brian Christopher, and Taka, and who else?
Was Rob Van Dam ever consideration? Because it seems like it at that time.
No, he was an ECW guy.
It seemed like they were just focusing like heavily more on him, and he had the whole Mr. Monday Night thing going. So I don't know if it was ever something that was supposed to maybe happen, but didn't. That kind of fell through.
Yeah, no, I think that was just always part of the ECW cross-promotion.
Okay.
But as far as the light heavyweight tournament, those were the three that really stuck out. I'd probably be surprised if I looked back and said, oh, damn, he was in it too.
Yeah, there was a lot of that at that point.
You know, because, like, was Devin Storm, Ace Darling, Danny Inferno, were any of those guys in it? I know Cornette was always very high on those Jersey guys, and rightfully so. They're very talented.
Darling definitely was. I think Storm was. If he wasn't in the tournament, he was definitely on. I remember seeing him.
Yeah, I think so. And I always, it's funny because I tease Ace all the time, you know, about him being on Raw, not being on Raw, being on WCW. I could swear he was. But yeah, there was a lot of that stuff, and that was when they were doing, the NWA stuff too?
That came later. That came like in early 98, I think.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, the light heavyweight tournament was just a mix of guys, and let's see who it was, and it wound up that Christopher and Taka were deemed the best two.
Right.
Speaking of the tournament, we just talked about a match that ended up possibly ending a guy's career. I'm actually trying to find the tournament to give you all the full guys. Scott Putski, who of course ended up here. Are the guys. Here's the guys, Kevin, that were in that tournament: Aguila, Super Loco, Taka, Devin Storm, Scott Taylor, Eric Shelley, Brian Christopher, and Flash Flanagan.
Right.
Were the guys in that tournament. So.
Okay. So Aguila, of course, wound up having the great run as S.A. Rios.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Shelley. I don't remember him.
I want to say he was from Canada, maybe. He's a Canadian?
You're probably right. I think you're right. But anyway, we're getting bogged down in minutiae here.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, tournament, good. Huh?
Yeah. Well, Justin and I both love tournaments. We always have. Scott Putski, was he a guy that was slated for bigger things? Because it seemed like he was a guy they were really pushing, you know, the whole feud with him and his dad. And then, his knee just turned to jello in that match at the pay-per-view. Was he ever thought of as a guy that was big for the light heavyweight?
Yeah, I think he had size. He had look.
He had size, all right.
And he had the name.
Yeah.
So, right, why not? But, yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah.
What does that mean, he had size, all right?
He was a big dude. He was jacked up.
He was jacked for a light heavyweight, that's for sure.
They were all jacked up.
Yeah. He was extra special juice, though. He was already a bust at that pay-per-view. Gang Wars, Kevin. You want to talk about it or no?
Quickly. Please.
What do you mean, Gang Wars?
You have 60 seconds. It's like the debate.
The Truth Commission, the Bariquas, the Disciples of Apocalypse, that whole mess. What did you think?
I liked all of it.
Really?
Really?
I did. I enjoyed all of it because it was...
Not the matches.
No, I mean, the matches were what they were, but it was just part of it was sort of the underlying theme, I thought, of the shows at the time.
Yeah.
You never knew what was going to happen next. It was always chaotic. It was always... There were fights breaking out everywhere. You know, they invested a lot in talent costs from when you think of it, just the head count alone.
Right.
But it was always fun to see. I always liked it. And I liked the guys. I liked everybody that was in it, you know? So that was always a lot of fun.
Did you picture like the Nation being kind of above those guys though? Was that kind of the pecking order of it?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah,
well, okay. That was because I had great reverence for my fellow Florida State alumnus, Ron Simmons.
Yes.
And so we don't want to dirty Ron's hands too much in this, or, you know, and it was Crush. And when did Owen get involved in that? Was that later?
Yeah, that was the next year.
Yeah, that was 98, yeah.
Yeah, but go ahead.
At this point, it was still... Ron Simmons and the Bowtie Brigade?
No, it was by the summer. It was because he fired all those guys, and that's why the other faction started. So it was Simmons, D'Lo Brown stayed, and then they brought in Kama, and I was on my Johnson for like a few weeks, and then he turned back, and then Rocky joined.
Right. After he came back from the knee injury?
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Let's talk about that now, because we had it on the list for later, but heel turn was great, obviously. Very a smart move and a well-done one.
talking to him beforehand, talking to him on the run up to it, knew it was going to be good. He was legitimately pissed at the crowd.
Yeah.
And legitimately hated them. And was never going to let them forget that. And sticking it up their ass all the time was his goal. And to get them to be his puppets, you know, and to be able to, you know, Rock would make them say things and cheer for things and be like, yay, we're dumbasses, you know. And that was just payback. So when Rock finally, he got enough of that debt, when he said, okay, we're even now. You know, he was already a millionaire several times over.
And I thought it was shrewd not having him get bogged down in the racial overtones of the whole thing that the Nation had kind of stood for up until then. Like, he basically came out and said it right away that this isn't a black or white thing. It's, you know, me hating you, the fans thing. That was smart.
That's what needed to change.
Yes.
Because, you know, it was great from an, and Vince does this a lot of times, you know, we'll start something very controversial and then we'll back it off subtly and slowly. So that, you know, so people can't turn around and say, well, it's, you know, it's the racist group. It's the guys that dress like Louis Farrakhan. No, it's
right.
Not. One of the guys last week just said it's not a black or white thing. Well, okay, but you did it at first to get it noticed. All right, maybe I did. You know.
Well, then it didn't help to have the white supremacist bikers in there feuding with them and the, you know, Hispanic group
and
as well.
And the Puerto Ricans.
Yes, exactly.
However,
we
just
did
the random South African.
Yeah, it was odd. Yeah. Where did that whole thing come from? Was it just because they had that tour there? They thought they should bring them over. What was the
again? Those guys were Brett recommendations.
Okay, Kurgan. Jackal was great. I mean, it always amazed me that. I mean, maybe you can shed some light on this. Did he just have issues backstage, or what was it with him? Because he was such a great talker. He seemed like a Vince kind of talker kind of guy.
Oh, everybody hated his guts. I liked him, but everybody hated him.
Really? Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Was he just outspoken, or what was it?
He was just a heater.
Yeah.
He just got heat on himself. I don't know what he did. Who knows? I loved him, though. I thought Don was so talented. I enjoyed working with him. Hmm. Very fantastic guy in my book.
Yeah, I mean, that was the you know, best part of that whole run for them when they...
Well, he wasn't the original manager, if you remember.
Right, the commandant.
The commandant.
The commandant was first.
Yeah.
That was an actor. He was an actor or something, right?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
It's funny. But it's funny we're talking about the whole black and white thing. Meanwhile, the Barriquas won pretty much every single match on Raw or on pay-per-view. It's very strange, but...
Well, that just goes to show you that wins and losses don't matter.
True.
True. Now, you were saying something about the Commandant? I didn't mean to cut you off. You said
all I said was is that he was a lot of fun. And he was a very talented man. And a fun guy to be around, you know. It was just weird that he was like the first non-wrestling person that I had been around in wrestling. You know, and then it became much more commonplace to have actors be playing the role of wrestlers, you know. But and then he didn't work out, and then they got Jackal in there, and then the fun started.
And the whole thing was pretty much to push Kurgan, right? Was that the whole goal of that?
Well, sure. I mean, they certainly looked at Kurgan and was like, my gosh, you know, 7 foot tall and guy's a big monster and he could do everything. And, you know, Brett was very high on him. So.
Interesting.
But what did it come down to? Can he talk?
Nope.
Nope.
Nope. Not at all. And then he became a oddity.
And he was an oddity.
Yes. But more on that next year.
Yes.
All right. Let's head into the Meadowlands. For the other big show of 1997, well, other, but second of the three, and that is, of course, SummerSlam. Before we get into the meat and potatoes of the show itself, Kev, we have the whole thing with Christy Todd Whitman and the whole Athletic Commission thing, and then they finally had to, not finally, I think we all knew it anyway, but they had to actually say publicly that it is sports entertainment. You know, they had the whole press conference, I remember, with Undertaker and Mayor and Governor Whitman and everything. What was the backstage thought on that? Were they happy to just say, yeah, it's staged and we just have fun here? And, you know, what was the thoughts on that, having to actually say in public that this was sports entertainment?
I think at the time, nobody really thought anything about it other than just, you know, it was sort of formality to be able to work in New Jersey again. But I think in hindsight, it turned out to be pretty much, the kind of the death knell of pro wrestling. and one more step to being the inevitable demise of what was a pretty thriving industry. I think when they look back in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because everybody knew what it was.
Right.
And this was the first time where they came out and said, it is what it is. You know, so when there is no more wrestling, which could be sooner rather than later, who knows? But for at least the time being, we have what we have left. But when there is no more wrestling, they will look back and say, damn.
And I feel that really? I feel the exact way about the whole Attitude Era. So I think when we get there, we're going to talk about that.
What do you mean?
I feel like the whole Attitude Era spawned from this moment where they unveiled things, and I think they were so into TV ratings and giving away these great matches on TV and not driving towards the pay-per-views and house shows anymore, and I think it was fantastic at the time for that three-year stretch, but I think if they looked back now, I think Vince, you know, in my eyes, outside of the money he made, if you're talking about just the detriment to the product in general, I think he would admit that it wasn't maybe the best move.
Well, again, you can point to what led to it. But every wrestling company is hotshotted. And that's all the Attitude Era was hotshotting. It just lasted a really long time. And they haven't gotten over it yet.
Right.
Every time you hotshot, for however long you do it, no matter the biggest high you have, you'll have a deeper and longer well that you'll eventually have to climb out of. So the business hotshotted for as long as it did, and we're in a very, very deep well. But this is the first time where we don't have the fan base that cares anymore.
Right.
So we've killed the golden goose, as it were. They keep trying to say, no, the golden goose is not dead. It's right here. It's fine. We just have to find a way to tap into the golden goose again. No, it's dead. And you killed it. You did. So
interesting.
That's the way it goes.
Yeah.
It's getting very depressing. Now, and non-depressing. Let's talk about Steve Austin's injury. That's not depressing.
Yeah.
Go on, Scott. So,
okay. Well, obviously we had the big big Intercontinental title match. Steve Austin and Owen Hart, Stone Cold, finally getting his big singles championship. And then we get the pile driver heard around the world.
Oh.
Talk about what happened after that. When Stone Cold was, well, first of all, what was it? What were people thinking backstage while obviously Vince was on the mic. What was going on backstage while, you know, Owen was just kind of walking in a circle, kind of not quite knowing what to do, and Austin wasn't moving. What were things like starting from that point on, and then the aftermath after the match and him walking backstage? What was going on in the back?
A lot of yelling and screaming, a lot of unsure. Again, a lot of unsure, and then rolled him up, but just did not know, okay, all right, he's okay. Because I think everybody's seen wrestlers get knocked out before. Everybody's seen wrestlers lose feeling for a few seconds. Everybody's seen it, but nobody saw it to this degree. And nobody realized how bad it was until afterward. So it was a collective sigh of relief. Whew, okay, great. You know, Owen put himself in the hold in 1, 2, 3, and we'll get through that, and Steve will get checked out and he'll be okay. But he wasn't okay. We didn't know that at the time. We only knew that afterward. But, yeah, that was bad. But then again, you know, getting to, you know, kind of overshadowing that was Sean having to toll the three for Brett to become the champion. And that was there, right? That was that one?
Yes. Yep.
Help
yes.
me, guys. Okay, yeah. Yep. So that was, you know, so Brett having to, you know, Sean having to look at Brett and then hit the canvas for the third time, and, you know, that was where Brett became the 5-time champion, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I did an interview with him afterward that was, it didn't really play anywhere, but it was a good interview. It was a damn good interview.
With Brett?
And it was more like a press conference. You know how, like, they do in sports? And, you know, it was a bunch of microphones and...
Yes, yep.
We kind of did that with him, and it was good. It was really good. It's kind of what they do in Japan. So, always wanted to see more of that. But anyway, and it was a shoot. It was him talking about being a 5-time champion and what it means to his family and his country and what he thinks about The Undertaker and what he thinks about Shawn Michaels and what he thinks about, you know, this and that. And he talked about Steve and he said, you know, he hates to see anybody get hurt and he hopes he's okay and, you know. So it was very, it was candid. It was great. Wish we would have done more.
What was the thought on the pile driver itself? That, I mean, you know, Austin obviously always blamed Owen, and you know, the stories that Owen never called to check on him or apologize, and it caused a lot of heat between the two. You know, is that true? Where was the fault lie? You know, was there heat on Owen from anyone else for doing that?
I don't think there was heat on Owen from anyone else other than Steve. Mm-hmm. And Steve never forgave him. And I don't know why Steve never forgave him. It wasn't exactly something you went up and asked him. So, you know, you never want to say somebody is making too much out of something because it's obviously very personal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think everybody... you know, I think everybody knew Owen to be the type of guy that there certainly wasn't malicious intent, but was there accidental stupidity? Maybe. So, where does the fault lie? I don't think anybody will ever know, and the only way Steve ever got past any of that was when after Owen died and he came out and he saluted Owen's picture and posted him, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was it. But I don't think they ever... publicly made amends or privately made amends. I'm not sure.
Do you think the neck injury actually helped Austin long term? Do you think he developed as well as a character without it, or do you think it didn't matter either way?
No. It hurt him.
Yeah.
It derailed him. He was going to go in that same direction anyway.
Okay.
It really affected everything. And just, you know, the only reason that it helped him is because I guess if seeing your life flash before your eyes and realizing that your career is coming to an end, if that helps you in any way, then it was helping him. But no, it was kind of like Pillman. He realized that, you know, he had a finite amount of time and that this was bad and his neck was in really bad shape. So.
Were they headed towards the whole thing with him stunning all the authority figures and McMahon anyway? See, because I always kind of got the feeling that they did that to keep him busy, and it kind of was a byproduct, but unless you can tell me otherwise, that they planned it anyway.
Again, may have been a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
May have been planned ahead of time. Not sure. Obviously, he couldn't be having matches.
Right.
But I think it was almost like, well, he doesn't need to have matches. The more matches he has, the better. Or the more matches he has, you know, the fewer matches he has, the better.
Right.
Make it special. Oh, okay, we're going to have him do this. You know, a lot of times Vince would be like, well, how are we going to keep Austin alive in the show? What are we going to do? And so that's what they came up with. So, yeah, maybe it did help in a way, but it took away from his ability to, you know, because as much as Steve enjoyed, you know, the stunners and the beer and the middle fingers. He took tremendous pride in his work. And I think that, you know, always bothered him.
I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah. You know, it was definitely a blow because he was having such great matches leading up to that.
Mm-hmm.
Going back quick to the Shawn Michaels-Bret Hart thing where, you know, he helped Bret win the title. Was there ever any plan? Because I remember there was a rumor at the time that they were so... against each other as far as refusing to ever work with each other, that there was a rumor that they were going to put them together as a team so they didn't have to work against each other. Was there ever any truth to that? Because if you watch that match, the way it unfolds, it almost looks like they're heading that way with Shawn. It was going to be revealed that he was working with Bret. Was there any truth to that, or just kind of, you know, mind-playing tricks?
I have no idea. I never heard that story before.
Okay.
I can't imagine those two guys being together in a room for 5 minutes.
Okay.
I think part of the reason why they only put Shawn in that match was because Taker was in there as well. And that Shawn wouldn't pull any nonsense with Taker in there because Taker would have killed him.
Mm. Yes, that's true. How do you think, getting to Taker for a minute, kind of going off our I did have a question. We had another question coming up, but this just came into my head when you mentioned him. What were your thoughts on Taker's title reign? You know, a lot of people think that it kind of took a back seat because of the Bret stuff with Steve and the you know and Shawn and all that stuff. What did you think of Undertaker in this run as champion? Do you think he did a good job? Well, I don't think he did a good job. Do you think it was overshadowed? Do you think he didn't get as much exposure as he should have as champion because of other stuff going on? What did you think of that title reign as a whole?
If there ever can be a transitional champion in terms of an absolutely legendary figure who was in the process of his own transition than that was Taker at that time. Mm-hmm. He was segueing out of being the Dead Man and was morphing into what eventually became American Badass. And he was while he was going in through that same transition, that same metamorphosis, he was also a transitional champion between Bret Shawn and Austin. So he did the best he could with what he had to work with. He didn't have, you know, he had good opponents. He didn't have great opponents. He held the title from March until August. So he did well with what he had to work with.
He's kind of a steadying force, too, through kind of like a chaotic year, just on-screen-wise. I don't even talk about backstage, but just on-screen. There was so much, you know, randomness and other things going on and chaos with the Hart Foundation, and he was just always kind of steady and always just the Undertaker with the title.
And if you gave him, you know, give him the mic and give him the time, but I think a lot of his character kind of felt a little flat, you know, and it didn't have that same cool factor anymore, but he would get it back.
Okay, I was curious.
Would you guys agree or no?
Well, I agree with you because I think Taker. I think he was calming anyway, even with all the chaos in the back, and I'm sure backstage he was the same way. I mean,
oh my gosh, yeah, he's incredible. But I'm just saying that on screen, the reason why his transitional title reign felt even more transitional was because he was transitioning as well.
Yep.
Yes.
But as far as a steadying, calming influence, and in the midst of all this chaos, we now present the Undertaker. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it worked both backstage and on screen as well. Because when Taker was around, there was very little nonsense, and you knew what you were getting, and the same thing happened when, you know, because you just didn't do that stuff with Taker, either way.
I agree that you could see him developing his, you know, because he didn't really have to talk a lot before that point. This is the first time he was really on his own, you know, cutting promos regularly, and he definitely seemed a little, you know, shaky early, but I think by the end of the year, he was definitely developing that persona, and like you said, it eventually would lead, I mean, he'd go through a lot of changes before the biker Taker thing, you know, through the whole evil phase and, you know, the ministry, but even through all that, he was always starting to develop that little bit of the biker attitude with him.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Did Taker, Kev, ever try and get in the middle of this Bret Shawn nonsense? Did Vince ever just put the three of them in a room and Taker just fucking grabbed the two of them by the throat and said, cut the shit? I mean, did he ever attempt to try and quell all this nonsense? Or was he like, you know what, let the two of them just beat the shit out of each other? Like,
I am not sure. You know, again, there's the boys and the office. And I was always on the office side.
Right.
And if something like that happened in amongst the boys, I didn't know about it, and I respected them too much to not ask.
Right. Fair enough.
So I think, you know, again, if somebody was to step in at some point and may have, wouldn't put it past me that it would be Taker. You know, but obviously those two and their egos and their problems with each other were bigger than the ability, you know, of one to be able to fix it. So it was what it was.
All right, so back to the storyline portion of it. Bret's title reign now, his fifth title reign, kind of felt a little like a lame duck title reign. You have Shawn passes him as a top heel. You have Austin and Undertaker as your top faces. You know, Shawn's feuding with Taker now. Bret's stuck in his feud with the Patriot. What were the thoughts on that? Was it truly like a lame duck title reign at that point?
Yeah, seeing Bret not main event, seeing the WWF champion not main event pay-per-views was, I didn't like that, you know. That wasn't,
I agree,
cool.
I don't either.
And that happened, what, twice?
Yes, and the second time was even worse because we watched, you know, the great Raw from MSG, and, you know, Bret wasn't even on, and they didn't even talk about that flag match. It was the tag flag match with him and Bulldog against Vader and Patriot, and that match was a complete afterthought heading into that show.
Right. Mm. That's the way it goes, you know? Hmm. It all worked out good in November, though, didn't it?
Yes, it definitely did. But those 2 months in between, I mean, the Shawn Taker stuff was phenomenal because you had the birth of DX at this point. You had Rick Rude's return. And, you know, what are your thoughts on the early stages of that? We had, you know, Shawn busted Taker open with that chair, and he did that sick, nasty blade job, and Rude showing up as the insurance policy, and, you know, Hunter and China started to develop more of a personality.
When did we have Hell in a Cell?
That was October. And DX, had just kind of started right before that.
Obviously, that was what came out of that time period, was the birth of Kane.
Right.
I don't think we can take away what that meant. The starting of the DX thing, and, you know, Rude, I just felt was kind of like a weird, he was all messed up on drugs, too. He just seemed weird to me.
Yeah.
You know? And then it wasn't too much longer where he was gone and on Raw, on Nitro the same night, and he's on both shows at the same time. I was like, what a dick, you know?
Yeah, it definitely was.
Where's his beard? Yeah. Damn, where'd his beard go?
He shaved his face. He's swerving us all. How will we ever come back?
And then he did absolutely nothing in WCW, nothing.
Yeah, right. No. And that was just everybody who had ever been nice to him, you know? It's like, this guy's like kind of a dick, and he's on both shows now at once. Oh, he really got over on us. But yeah, that to me is what came out of that time frame, was the birth of Kane and the Hell in a Cell, and Hunter, China, Sean, getting DX up and running. That was a lot of good stuff in that time frame.
From a business side, Kev, something that I think we and JR and I reviewed this show, both on paper and on the podcast. A show that really I think marked a big push on the business side for the WWF at the time was the first UK pay-per-view, one night only, because you know this was a time that they would go you guys would go overseas for house show tours and things like that, and the occasional Raw. But this was big, you know, a pay-per-view only for the UK. And what did you think of that whole kind? The card is really cool. It has some really unusual matches. The great Taker Bret rematch, and of course, that chaotic Shawn Bulldog main event. What were your thoughts on that show as a whole? First of all, you went over there?
No, I didn't.
You were not over there. I was trying to think who was doing the. Oh, must have been Michael Cole.
Yeah, it wasn't me.
And I think it was you. Bummer. How come you didn't go? There's a question.
I think I was still in my TV hiatus at that point.
Oh, okay.
Or I was just coming out of it. Okay. They screwed the pooch. They didn't put the belt on the European guy. They took the belt off the European guy. Hmm. In the UK, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's where Shawn beat him for the European title, and they pretty much just destroyed him. And, I mean, I get that they're trying to build heat for Shawn and all that, but the thing that made it look worse is that the Hearts were played off like idiots. No one came out and saved Bulldog. He got his ass kicked by all of DX, and then the whole thing was just really, came off like a slap in the face.
He was in the figure four for what seemed like 20 minutes, and, like, no one's coming out and helping him. It was really, you know, and all this in front of his sister who was sick, and, you know, and And I remember Shawn on his My Journey DVD saying, you know, we really wanted to come up with, you know, good heat. And I get that. But I think they could at least ended it a little more dignified. Everything post-Bell was probably unnecessary.
Right.
But from a business viewpoint, did they do well off that pay-per-view? Did that, you know, was it a good thing for them?
How many more did they do?
I think they did a bunch over the next couple of years, I believe.
Maybe like five, maybe? Five or six, probably.
Really?
I think
they did.
Yeah.
Capital Carnage.
We don't have to go through them all, but there was a few in 98 and a few in 99.
I only remember the one, and I hated it.
Really?
Hated it.
Because of that finish or just in general?
Yes, because of that finish. It's the Road Warriors against Tully and Arn in Chicago. Starcade. How do you not put the Road Warriors over in that? You killed Chicago.
Yep.
Don't get me started on that. I have my own issues with that as well, K-squared. I agree with you on that.
So that was just my whole thing.
Yeah. Hey, Kev, I know the last one was in 03, the last UK pay-per-view. I think it was 03. So they haven't done one in a long time, but yeah, they did about five or six.
Kev, what did you think of the transition from the great Todd Pettengill to Michael Cole at this time? What were your thoughts of Cole coming in?
Cole was hired to be my replacement.
Oh, okay. Actually.
And it kind of all backfired on them because I didn't get fired. Vince wanted me back on TV, and I rode with Cole a couple of times and smartened him up. So
backfired, definitely.
Yeah, that was Kevin. No, he was fine. I only met Todd Pettengill a couple of times at a couple of the pay per views in '96. He was all right. I like Cole. I thought he was a cool dude.
I think he comes across. I think he catches a lot of shit because he's kind of the voice of a time period that people aren't fond of. But I think as a person, he always seems like a pretty, you know, down to earth guy.
No, as a person, he's a prick.
Oh, okay.
Oh, he's a prick bastard. But I enjoy that about him.
Okay.
He's a good family man, loves his wife, loves his kids, just can be miserable, though. Oh, what a kvetch. What a whiny baby he could be.
All right.
Oh, my gosh. But it was always fun.
Yeah.
You know, we bust his balls, and he put up with it, and he'd give it back. And it was all good-natured fun.
He's had a hell of a run. I mean, to be from 97 till now, and he's, you know, still going strong.
And he wasn't a wrestling guy.
Right.
So, yeah, he's always, and again, the stuff that he did recently with Lawler, you know, that proved his value to me, so.
We talked, let's see, look at our little list.
And I mean the stuff that he did when Lawler had the heart attack.
Right, yes, not the feud.
Is a new story.
Well, yeah, we were just talking about that, and actually, we want to get to Lawler. We want to do that at the end. We'll jump ahead to that. But
oh, please.
Please, yes or no?
Please, I can't wait for the end.
Okay.
Oh, that was very Heyman-ish.
So anyway, but you know, the Cole stuff, we were just talking about this last week. We kind of did our headline show, and we talked about how Cole really, they were smart to take advantage of that situation and turn him back from being the dick heel to just being Michael Cole again. I thought it was a well-played, it was a time to do it, and it was good that they took the opportunity, and he was great in the role.
Absolutely right, and just let him be exactly what he's supposed to be.
Yep.
You know? Yep. So, and get off this stupid hatred of Jim Ross, for love of God.
Yes.
Yeah, that was getting pretty tired as well.
Well, it's good to see JR back. We'll see how long it lasts. But okay, so anyway, back to 97 here. So coming off of Hell in a Cell, obviously, was the night Brian Pillman, or the night before that, Brian Pillman passed away. I think we got into this a little bit last time, but obviously, what was the feeling backstage? Was it shocked, expected, matter of time kind of thing? What was the feel?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Pillman's passing. Was it, you know, shocking to everyone backstage?
Oh my
gosh,
yes, it was terribly shocking. Nobody, again, I wasn't there that day, so, you know, I was back at the TV studio and kind of manning the fort, like on the AOL side, and we were hearing the stories and reports of it, and we were trying to find out what the scoop was, and, you know, just a long processional line of wrestler death seemed to follow and had already preceded him with Louis Piccoli, I believe. And, you know, just, it's sad. It was always sad, you know, and thinking about Melanie and thinking about their daughter, and it just wasn't, you know, it was very uncool.
What are your thoughts on the Melanie interview?
I didn't hate it like some did. I thought that, you know, I don't know.
Was it a ratings grab, or do you think that the heart was in the right place to get the word out?
I think the heart was in the right place. I think it was a little bit disingenuous. I think it was self-serving on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a double knockout. They both wanted to get themselves over, Vince and Melanie. And out of that, it was, you know, nobody shone through because it came across so badly.
Right.
But I think at the core of it, you know, it started off with the idea of it'd be nice to hear from her.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was exploited.
And I think the way it was done was bad, because instead of just having maybe her speak on her own, or you have someone softer sit with her, like Ross or Cole or yourself, you know, not that you're soft, but softer than Vince. You know, Vince basically like grilled her, you know, she's like breaking down crying and he's like yelling at her to answer the question. So I think that did not help things.
Yeah, it was very strange. But who knows?
That whole time frame was strange.
She was working her own angle, though.
You think just trying to get a job or just trying to get...
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Okay.
Really?
Oh, please. And it didn't stop then. Give me a break.
Really?
Wow.
So she kept pounding?
Yes.
Wow. There's an angle I've never
heard
before.
Look at every woman through the 1990s in professional wrestling. You can name them on one hand. And I'm not talking wrestler.
Right.
So take Sherry out of the mix.
Yep.
Missy Hyatt. Sonny. Sable. Terry Runnels. Throw Melanie Pillman and Diana Hart in the mix. Common denominator in all of it. Sex with wrestlers leads to a little bit of fame and glory, failed relationship, and basically do anything they can to try to get that again. And will whore themselves out for the chance to be in the spotlight once again.
It's interesting, the Diana-Melanie comparisons. I never really thought of that. And I felt this way about Diana all this time. I just never connected it with Melanie, maybe because she barely was ever on.
Exactly. But it was that belief. You know? And I'm sorry, you're not a diva. You're not a celebrity. Your husband is dead. Go get a job. You know?
Mm-hmm.
No one owes you for anything. I don't care what your last name is.
Mm-hmm. What? I may be going down the wrong road with this, and we can cut me off if I am. But so, what are your thoughts on Vicky Guerrero?
Just a devious, evil woman.
Really?
Who stole all of Eddie's money and cleaned his bank account out and broke his heart. And yeah, they might have patched things up and put things back together, but she was an evil woman.
Wow.
Wow.
You know, and like I said, they may have put the past behind them before he died. I have no idea. But I'm not saying she's not talented on screen. I just have no interest in looking at her. So, and, you know, listen, Eddie was probably no saint either. Eddie probably made a lot of mistakes along the way. I'm not saying he didn't treat her badly or didn't do anything wrong. Absolutely not. But don't, you know, don't put yourself off as the victim when you're an equal party to it.
Well, what I think is interesting is that I feel like the perception of a lot of fans was that, you know, Vince and the WWE was forcing her to be on camera as a way to keep, like, the payments coming that they had promised. So they were almost, you know, trying to drag her in to keep the Eddie storyline going. But I always kind of felt differently. I always kind of felt like she wanted that role, and it seems like you're backing that up.
Oh, yeah, they absolutely wanted it. But look at the line that I just drew you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You think it's all of a sudden going to stop because we changed decades?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely not.
Right.
So, you know, there are fame whores, and then there are classy women.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And Sherry Martel had a ton of problems. Luna had a ton of problems. But neither of them were ever raised like that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
They could always rely on their work. And they made mistakes, and they eventually paid for it with their lives, but always had a different set of respect for them because of where they came from and the dues that they paid as opposed to somebody else who just got there because they slept with someone.
You'll get an argument from us there. Big, big Sherry fans and Luna, too.
Yes. Yes. No, for both of them. I don't want to continue along this thread, but
we got to wrap this up, boys. We got to move it along.
All right, let's move it along. Let's get to Montreal. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Spill
okay.
It.
All right, Montreal.
We need to do a whole show about Montreal.
Okay, so you want to do a separate Montreal.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
We need to do November and December of 97.
Okay. All right, we'll
Wouldn't
do it separate.
You agree?
Yeah, oh, I agree.
We've been on for like an hour and 45 minutes.
Okay. we get so much to talk to you about. It's so great.
I know.
That's what I mean. But we need to just, if we start the Montreal thing, we're going to be here for another hour.
Okay.
And I think fans are going to go, ugh.
I disagree.
You know what I mean?
I disagree with that. But we will. I agree that it does need to be its own show. So let's
its own pay-per-view.
Yes, definitely. We will charge for it.
Yes, we will.
All right, so we'll wrap the 97 part there then, and we'll save Montreal.
All right, now, Yes. When is this going to be back on? When is this going to be? When are you going to release this podcast?
As long as my power doesn't go out, this will be up tonight.
All right. How about this? In 2 weeks.
Okay.
Let's
sure.
Let's do 2 weeks from tonight.
That's the one night. I cannot do, Kev. I can't do that Monday. I have Providence College basketball season tickets. I got a game that night.
Providence College basketball season tickets.
Yes, November 12th. We have a game.
If you handed those tickets out to somebody,
yes,
you said, "Here, I'm going to give you 2 courtside seats to Providence College, or I'm going to give you $5 cash."
Hey, you see a lot of good teams. This is Big East basketball, bud.
They would take the $5 cash.
Oh, get out of here.
The tickets are worthless.
They're not worthless.
How about that Wednesday?
That's fine.
The 14th?
Okay. Wednesday the 14th, right? Wednesday
the 14th it is.
Okay. See, was that hard?
Okay.
No, it's not hard, but it gives me an opportunity to pepper you about Providence College. Is that wheelchair basketball?
Oh, God.
Donkey basketball?
God. You're outing yourself as a novice.
What is it?
What is it? D1 Big East basketball. What do you mean?
It's midgets playing basketball.
Okay.
Oh, it's Providence.
Enough.
Oh, they still have basketball there?
I'm going to make sure that no one goes to the next Ring of Honor show here if you keep this up. I'm going to insure it.
Wait a minute now. You weren't at the last one. You don't know how good it was.
I know it was good. Yeah, all your shows are good. I watch it weekly on the CW here. See the plug
the
I'm giving you?
28.
Yes.
Yeah, I got to. You know what? I have something to say too, Kevin, because I live in Connecticut, and my CW does not have Ring of Honor, which I'm very upset about because, you know, this is obviously a hotbed here, this avenue, you know, for Ring of Honor, and I don't get it here in Connecticut. I'm a little bummed about that. What should I do?
Well, you should watch the show every week at ROHWrestling.com.
Okay.
And not be a cheapskate and get a premium membership so that you could see it on Monday.
You got a problem. One problem there is Scott's very old and inept when it comes to the internet. We have to handhold him through all these things.
Do I have to stick a dollar into the laptop?
Sometimes it's quarters. You can break it.
Oh, nice. It's like one of those penny arcades.
Basically, it's only going to be on Sinclair-owned stations. So if Sinclair buys the station there in Hartford, then you could be in the mail. Wait, are you in New Haven or you're in New
I'm
Haven,
actually,
right?
No, I'm actually in Fairfield County. I live, if you know Connecticut, so
I used to live in Shelton.
Okay, I live in Norwalk. So I'm 8 exits from Titan Towers. I know Shelton very well. So, all right, we'll have to do that then. So that Wednesday, the 14th.
I like how we dodged the whole internet question, but... yes, Kevin, it seems like a good, seems like they have a good relationship with the CW affiliate here. I mean, it's just a benefit of Sinclair, but they pimp it a lot. I see a lot of ads and a lot of local stuff on their website and whatnot.
You should call the locals, you should call the station, and you should tell them thank you.
I will.
It's up to the station as to what they do.
Yeah, they do
Sinclair
a lot.
Sinclair provides the broadcast to them. And whether or not the station decides they want to run promos for it and tell people about it is up to them. And the CW28 is one of our great partners.
Yeah, they do a good job, and I follow them on Facebook and Twitter and all that, and they're always always talking about it, always plugging it, so that's cool. Any other Ring of Honor you want to talk about, plug, anything?
Final Battle, Sunday, December 16th at 2 p.m. at the Hammerstein Ballroom. It's the biggest event of the year, and the card's going to start to take shape over the next few weeks. I can tell you it's going to be a mix of names of past, present, and future. For Ring of Honor, so
excellent.
I think it's going to be a little bit of something for everybody, and that's really it. We're gearing up for a huge 2013. I think there's going to be some big excitement coming down the aisle.
Now you're definitely going to do a show that Friday night before of WrestleMania weekend.
Yes, that would be our return to New York.
Yep,
we're only doing one this year. We're going to focus on making one good one as opposed to. You know, the stress and strain of having to do 2 back-to-back.
Right.
In a weekend where they're going to see so much other wrestling anyway.
Yeah, so saturated.
Let's do one special one.
Well, we're planning on getting tickets to Mania, hopefully. So we're going to be there for the weekend. So our plan is to go to the show Friday night, and hopefully as VIPs of Kevin Kelly will be the goal.
You know it. Well, I think it's going to be harder for you to get a ticket to the Ring of Honor event than it will be to get tickets to WrestleMania.
Well, no, because you're going to give us Ring of Honor. Because what do you mean it's going to be hard? It's going to be very easy.
The phone is breaking up here. I got okay. Storm is rolling in.
Before we wrap.
Is that Walter's guy again? We don't know who you're talking about.
I have no idea who these two are. They claim to know John Walters. I've never seen them before in my life.
We don't know Joe Walters. We know AJ Brewer. All right, quick. Tell us about Jerry Lawler, the heart attack and all that. Go ahead. Spew it.
What do you mean, tell us about the heart attack with Jerry Lawler?
Spew it. You said you had things to say. You couldn't wait till the end.
About Michael Cole, about how great a job he did.
Well, we wanted to know your thoughts on the Lawler part of it.
What were you thinking, or how did you find out when it first,
Arta,
first
I was following. I was looking on Twitter, and I saw Arta Ocal, my good friend, who was there at the show in Montreal, and said, something just happened with Jerry Lawler. It doesn't look good. And mm-hmm. I flipped over to USA, and you could see that, you know, there was something going on. And then they read that they had stretched him out. I was like, he's dead. He is dead.
Right.
Yeah.
And by all intents and purposes, apparently he was dead.
Yep.
And they revived him.
Mm.
So the best thing that ever could have happened to Jerry Lawler is that he had a heart attack while he was live on the air in Raw.
Yes, no doubt.
Pretty much.
And that for all the grief that fans have given the WWE about their wellness policy and about no blood on TV and blah, 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 they've got a lot of medical staff on hand. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why Jerry Lawler's still alive today. If he would have had that heart attack in an airplane, dead.
Mm-hmm.
Would have had the heart attack in a hotel room, dead. Indie show, dead. His own house, dead. The fact that he had it there in Montreal saved his life.
Mm-hmm.
And Opie and Anthony's impression of Vince McMahon talking about Jerry Lawler was hysterical. I don't know if you guys got a chance to hear that.
No, we did not.
I got to hear it.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I got to hear it. It was pretty.
Get him up!
Yeah,
get him back in the chair!
Yeah, it was pretty funny.
I love when they do Vince. It's hysterical.
Yeah, it is pretty funny. They haven't had Shane on in a while. They used to have Shane on a lot. They haven't had him on. Yeah, that's pretty funny.
You think Lawler will be back?
He'll probably be back by Christmas time.
Think he should be back?
Yeah, I think he's going to be.
You think he should be?
Oh, sure. Why not?
Okay. Just curious.
I wouldn't put him in the ring.
No.
The first heel that snatches him up by the hair and throws a punch in his chest. Ooh-wee. Talk about easy heat.
True.
Would you put him back in the booth, or do you think he'd be better as like a ambassador?
No, you put him back in the booth. Absolutely. Okay. I think there's no better way to be an ambassador than that. I think you minimize his travel schedule. I think you take it easy on him.
Okay.
You know, I wouldn't put him, you know, hey, you got to fly to Europe and you got to fly to Timbuktu and now come back to, you know, Schenectady, New York for a ticket on sale. Let's take it easy on him. Mm. And let him just be the king.
Interesting.
Okay.
So.
And then see how he feels, you know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
6 months from now, a year from now, he might be better than ever. He might make some dietary changes. He might increase his exercise. He might feel better than ever. Okay, why not? One massive heart attack doesn't mean that it's, you know, he's an invalid. But what's he doing post, you know, episode? How's he caring for himself now?
Now, he's made it clear, I think, that he wants to wrestle again. So we'll see. I mean, you know, you'd better run him through every medical test possible if you're WWE before you put him in the ring. That's all I know.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah.
You know, your worst fear is that he has another heart attack.
Yeah.
I don't think Vince will ever put him in the ring again. I think if he ever wrestles again, it'll be some side projects. Sure.
He'll do indie shows. He's already back doing booking dates. Are you kidding me? He's doing autograph sessions. He's doing everything like that. He's not going to stop. But if you're WWE, you got to protect yourself.
Oh, without a doubt.
I got a question. On a side note, I know you got to go, Kevin. We keep going along, and we appreciate you on this very unusual evening of here in the Northeast to talk wrestling. But I wanted to talk to you. A few weeks ago, I went to the Legends of the Ring convention in Monroe, New Jersey. A friend of mine's friend runs one of those memorabilia businesses, so I got to go and walk around. And there was apparently an incident between Vader and Harley Race, shoving match of some sort, a screaming match. Vader apparently smacked his vendor guy in the back of the head and was yelling in the lobby in front of kids and everything. My question to you is, does that surprise you?
Well, yes, it does. And I'll tell you why, because Vader, you know, I don't know whether or not, I don't know what feelings he may have had for Harley Race, but I don't know anybody that doesn't respect and fear Harley Race. Mm. And I know that Vader has made a concerted effort to improve his image and to change some things in his life that needed changing. And so when you see something like that, you feel badly because, you know, geez, I know that he was working on trying to improve some things and may have fallen back into some old habits. And I don't know whatever could have happened that would have set him off with Harley, but certainly that's not the reaction that you would have for somebody that's as revered as Harley Race is. And considering Harley's physical state now, basically he's in a wheelchair, he doesn't exactly pose a strong physical threat.
Right.
You know, but then again, Vader was a guy who, when he was at his toughest and his baddest and his meanest, got taken down by Paul Orndorff in a WCW locker room while Orndorff was wearing flip-flops. So, and this was one-arm Paul Orndorff before he had, you know, well, he still had massive arm problems. So Vader was always a strong fixture of his own imagination. And, you know, but I know he had worked to make amends with a lot of those things, and that's an unfortunate thing. So I never heard the fallout from that. I should talk to the Fink and find out what's going on.
Yes, but the Fink was there.
I did the last Legends of the Ring, and that was great. Those guys run a great show, man. It's fantastic. I'm sure James was, the promoter, was very upset by that.
It was a lot of fun, and they're doing another one on June 8th in Monroe. My friend's name is Marcus. He runs, I don't remember the name of his promotion, something Investments. And he had Slick and Tatanka. And it was a really fun show for those that missed it. It was a good time. And it's going to head back to that same hotel, the Crown Plaza in Monroe on June 8th.
Tell him you ought to bring me and some Ring of Honor guys in. I got an idea for him.
Oh, I'd love for you to be there. I'll talk to my buddy and see what happens. I'd love to have that happen. That'd be great.
I'll pitch an idea to him. He'll love it.
Oh, awesome. And JR can finally scoot his way in here. So.
No, if Kevin hooks me up with a ticket, I will.
Oh, my God.
All right, Kevin Kelly, everybody. Great.
You're like Bobby Heenan now. We got to dress it up. Like the aunt and uncle again or whatever. Oh, jeez.
So, Kevin, we want to thank you so much for taking all this time. We're glad we finally got to do it. And this is why we're so persistent, because we know how awesome it is when you come on.
Yeah, you know, and again, it's my pleasure, and we want to make sure that the fans get their value out of the stories and kind of taking this time back and looking back at things, it helps me remember some stuff. So it's cool. Good mental exercise for when I, you know, the older I get.
All right. So initially we'll schedule for the 14th, and then we'll probably push it back 3 or 4 times. But we'll get it in. We're going to talk about Montreal.
We have to talk about November's Survivor Series before this actual November.
Okay.
Is complete. Okay.
That is definitely our goal.
So the 14th. Absolutely.
Okay.
14th, perfect. We'll make it happen.
It looks like there may be a return to Survivor matches this year. So we'll see.
Well, who knows?
Yeah, could be anything.
It'd be nice.
All right. So, Kevin Kelly, everyone, thank you so much, Kevin. The best.
All right. Talk to you guys in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Thanks, Kev.
Yep.
Okay. Kevin Kelly, great as always, Scott. Definitely. I thought it was almost better than the first one.
Yes. And once again, a sequel.
Yeah. One that he set up. It was like Bruno all over again. These guys set these sequels up on us.
I booked myself. Yeah.
So, yeah, Kevin will be back in 2 weeks' time. You heard him. He mocked me along the way, but we have him set for the 14th. Which will be that Wednesday. We'll talk to him. We'll go over Montreal. We'll go through December leading into 98. So it should be a lot of good stuff to talk about, just that one event on its own.
Yes. Oh, yeah. He's right, though. That we can't. We've talked about this extensively about Montreal, and when we had Kyle Forchetti on for the vault, it's just too important of a moment in history to chintz the time on. And
no, definitely not.
And, so K-Squared was absolutely right. It needs its own piece. So yep. He'll be back in a couple weeks. That'll be a lot of fun.
I agree. And speaking of upcoming shows, we have another show Wednesday night. We should be clear of the hurricane, tropical storm, nor'easter, super mega storm, Frankenstorm, yes. Sandy here. And yes. So Wednesday, we should be good to go. We have a little Halloween trick-or-treat for you. We're not going to tell you what it is, but I think it'll be a fun little show. And, of course, that'll have our NFL predictions as well. Next week, big week, we have Royal Rumble 98 on Monday. Mm-hmm. Should be a lot of fun there. And we have a switch in the schedule. We'll be recording Tuesday night, the long-awaited WCF podcast. WCF is, of course, the Backyard Wrestling Federation here in Rhode Island that I ran, along with Mr. Josh Richer, Mr. Andrew Flanagan, and a couple of our other friends. Josh and Andy will be joining us. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go through the history of the promotion, share the characters with you, share the cards with you. It lasted about, I think it was about a 2-year run that we had. So we're going to go over all that. Scott will be part of that as well. And then we're going to have a cool little contest for you coming off of that, chance for you to earn a spot on a Vintage Vault with us. So stay tuned. I think it'll be fun. We'll have some special things planned for that episode. Yes. So again, we'll be back Wednesday. It'll be a Halloween special episode. We hope you enjoyed our chat with Kevin Kelly. And of course, I hope you all, or we hope you all stayed safe throughout the rest of the storm as it dwindles down up towards our friends up in Canada. So
let's see. Do we have anything else we have to? Oh, just a reminder. Thursday begins November.
Yes.
And you know what that means. That is the Jay Wimette contest. The PTB Nation member who puts up the most funds for our good friend Mr. Wimette will be rewarded kindly when we have for them, JR. Do we announce a... We did.
Yes, we did. They can appear on a Vintage Vault of their choosing. They can select a throwback review for us to do. Anything of their choosing, we will watch and review. And they earn 10 additional bonus discs to their order, courtesy of Jay.
Yes, Jay's... he sent out a note about his orders. He's doing the best he can right now. He was bedridden for a little bit. But usually when he's bedridden, he says he actually mows through more because he's got nothing else to do.
Right.
So he's an awesome guy. Continued prayers for him. Yeah, he was telling me about a couple of 2CW shows coming up. If I remember the dates correctly, I believe it is Friday night, November 16th in Watertown, New York, and Saturday night, November 17th in Binghamton. He asked if I would attend. I'll certainly try. It's a hike from here. It's almost 4 hours, so I'll have to look into that. But for those that are closer, I know our buddy like Greenhouse and those guys are a little bit closer.
Yep.
Maybe they can make it out there. But Jay's an awesome guy. My order arrived over the weekend. Yours, JR, coming soon.
Shipped today, yeah.
Yes. So Jay's an awesome guy. So the contest is to have some fun, but it's also to help him out because he definitely needs it and deserves our help because he's a good guy. So.
Right. And since we didn't have a break tonight, I just want to quickly plug the wrestling forums, the TWSnews.com.
Yep.
We are on there. Graham's going to be getting his stuff on there. All our other friends and affiliates run through there as well. So check that out. Of course, hit us up on Stitcher. The message board, Bigelow34.proboards.com, on Twitter, Place Number 2B Podcast, and on Facebook, of course, we have a couple spots on there to search Place to Be, and it'll show up for you. So, for Scott Criscolo, I am Justin Rosero. Everyone stay safe the rest of the storm. We will talk to you Wednesday night for Halloween.
Bye, Kev.
That was your weakest one so far.
I know. I was going to say something about the Seminoles.
Greetings, Clearwater, and I put a spell on you.